It's the Digital Press Podcast coming to you in Technicolor.
4K.
Oh, are we rolling?
Are we rolling?
I don't know. Yeah, all right.
Are we rolling?
We can start now. And we are rolling, but
welcome to episode. What episode are we on?
This is 7, right?
Been gone for a while.
6?
Episode 6. You're allowed to
from
talk
the future. Welcome to the Digital Press Podcast from the future. Episode
future.
7.
I'm
actually 6.
I'm 3D right now.
6. 6. As our sound guy is proudly displaying 6. 6.
And to all of you millions of guys behind the camera, don't feel shy. You can speak up. Even you, Michael.
Digital Press Podcast is filmed live in front of a studio audience at the Digital Press Store.
Get
our
off
sound
the
guy.
Stage, Frankie! So it seems like a long time since we've all been here together. I know I have missed a few of these, and I've been spectating from afar. But even just as far as regular episodes go, it seems like it's been a while.
It has been.
Talked.
Yeah, it has.
So much has happened.
So much has happened.
Too much.
People have bought games, they've played games, some have cried. Some have had happiness.
A console generation is almost coming to a close.
Gabe was killed and then resurrected.
Yes.
As was
form.
Nick.
Nick hasn't gone through the resurrection process. He's still a zombie.
Mm. Are we counting the Wappy Dog episode? Or
he was killed because of the Wappy Dog episode. Joe listened to it. Nick came to work one day.
That was before the zombie episode. Okay, I thought that's when he was.
Shovel to the brain, and yes. Nick was gone for a while.
Well,
he'll be back.
The zombie thing would explain the Wappy Dog episode. That's why I'm a little confused.
We're getting really meta now. Yeah. It's for those of you who are hardcore Digital Press Podcast listeners and know all of our in jokes.
All three of you.
Yep. All three of our in-jokes also.
Two in our sound guy.
And we love you dearly.
So the first subject tonight was PAX East, right? I'm wearing my PAX East shirt.
Your enforcer shirt.
I went through all of the permutations of getting myself entrenched in the PAX East staff. So I have this really cool PAX. I'll try to do this without breaking the wires. I was an enforcer. Not actually voted, but probably the worst enforcer ever, because I didn't study any of the materials. I was sort of like a honorary enforcer, but not the oldest one, I was told.
That's good.
Which was good.
Yeah.
There were a lot of kids around, but
there were.
Yeah.
I think I was present for a couple times when people walked up to you and said, "Excuse me, where's the coat check?" And you were like, "I don't know."
You're wearing a coat, dude. I tried to be.
Oh, you
like
can
that.
Give it to me.
Yeah, I'm the coat concierge.
There were definitely a few awkward moments where I'm like, oh shit, I'm wearing my PAX East enforcer. I'm supposed to know this.
You were officially...
My daughter's been shot. What do I do?
I don't know. Have you tried calling 911?
Over there is the guy.
There's a guy over there. He'll help you.
I hear
he's
CPR
wearing
is a good thing to do nowadays when
enforcer
someone gets shot.
Shirt.
I hear you were actually the reason that Keith Apicary got kicked out of PAX.
Yeah, I know there's this rumor that he tried pulling his pants down or something, but I wasn't
actually?
There to...
You instructed him to do that.
I did. I said it would be okay.
Picture.
I thought it would
he
be...
He saw you were an enforcer, and you had no idea
yeah,
that it would break
like,
his contract.
He said, would it be okay if I pulled my pants down in the middle of the... I'm like, of course. Look, it says enforcer. What do you mean?
I know of no such rule that prohibits that activity. Go ahead.
So I probably won't try that again, but I will milk the shirt for all it's worth.
I would assume you're also on duty when that girl almost got kicked out for that revealing outfit.
No, actually, Joe didn't make it down to the show floor and see the girl that was...
Do you see me?
She was promoing... she was a booth babe, essentially, for Lollipop Chainsaw.
Oh, yeah. I heard about her. I did not see her.
Is that the Suda game? Is it not a Suda game?
I don't think it is.
Is he a producer? No? He's not a producer.
He might
you
be
can
involved.
See me. I'm
not 100% sure, but it's, okay. It's got that vibe.
It's got that vibe, and it's directed by...
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm not following the conversation. What are we...
I'm just making sure I'm in frame. I'm sorry. I can't... My eyes said I can't see
Mike's
Google
directing
screen.
From
people are tuning out right now because Mike's not in frame. I can't see all of Mike! I'm turning this podcast off right now. I'm writing a nasty letter to my congressman.
And the one guy who listens to us only on his iPod, what the hell is he talking
so
about?
What's the story? Was there a costume wardrobe malfunction?
Jennifer Negri, I think her name is.
Yeah.
I don't know if
she
that's her first name.
Very, she was in an outfit that was pretty much V-shaped from her breasts almost down to the crotch. So just like at the top, that's where the V stops, and so you could all bear up here. And apparently that crossed the line. None of the other cosplaying that was borderline that level seem to have affected anyone.
Okay.
But I guess because she was actually hawking a product.
Jessica Negri and well, the
what
problem
do you mean they let her wear the costume, but then she got escorted out, or
I think a parent complained and they told her she had to change.
Oh, a parent.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to be there.
What was interesting? What was interesting is that she was there as a paid cosplayer from WB Games, who are producing Lollipop Chainsaw, and
you could probably
so the show itself.
I sadly missed that.
The show itself. I mean, Frankie and I spent the entire 3 days there, plus some setup and breakdown time. But I mean, I'd like to hear from you, Mike. You were there. You went in for a brief period of time. You have some excellent footage, I'm sure, to share with people.
We will be showing that, actually.
What was your impressions of the show in general? It was the first time you'd been to a PAX of any kind, right?
Yeah, no, I've the biggest convention I think I've been to was Philly Classic or Video Game Expo, which is nothing compared to PAX. I didn't really understand the scope of what I was getting myself into. I had to actually park on off-site parking, and their parking lot, if anybody's been there, is huge, is absolutely huge. But they had a shuttle bus that kept going, and I was there for about 5 hours. I brought a friend of mine who helped me out with sound and whatnot. He had a great time. It was really it was pretty awesome. I mean, there was just a lot of people in the games, a lot of people, you know, just checking out new products. This is like a big party.
Good vibe, right?
Yeah, it was a great.
Did you make it down to the actual convention floor?
Yes, I did. I there's actually you'll be seeing footage of the convention floor. I was walking through and whatnot, and if you saw me with the camera, I looked like me, but with more hair then, which was just last.
It was actually
it
all
was,
coming out of his
it
right
was
cheek.
All,
it
was
just like a big
crazy.
It's been
hair.
A rough couple of days for you, I take it.
It was crazy.
You lost all that hair.
Oh God, yeah, it was awful. I'm still feeling that. But no, I actually really enjoyed the show. The arcade setup was really awesome. They had like 80s music playing, and it was my friend was like, wow, this was like high school. He was.
You mean the American, the arcade history?
The one that was on the opposite side
of.
ACAM.
Yeah. It's the Arcade History Museum, basically, that sets up there. And they're the guys from Fun Spot, right up in New Hampshire.
Oh, is that Fun Spot?
Oh, yeah.
I want to go to Fun Spot.
They bring those 30 or 40 machines to PAX East every year and set up the disco ball and the projector. And
they had laser lights
good stuff,
this year.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, really it was very cool. It was a very cool vibe. And everybody was just, it was friendly. It was all like a happy-go-lucky experience. You know, there was a lot of, you know, hawking of wares that are coming out. I saw some cool games that are coming out. I guess Joe Danger has a new one, Joe Danger, the movie. That looked really cool. But yeah, and I saw breakdancing zombies.
Breakdancing zombies. I saw disco dancing claptrap.
You will see breakdancing zombies in a moment. I will magically put it on your screen.
Excellent.
Yes, but it was very cool. And the Classic Gaming Expo area as well was, you know, where they had all these old game systems set up and whatnot. I spent a lot of my time there as well. And there was almost an interview with a Mr. Joe Santulli there that was snarked up quickly by another group of people.
Yeah, I felt bad about that. So Mike comes, he's like, I want to make sure I get you on camera. I want to do a quick interview here. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I really don't want to do this. And then
I drove up to Boston from New Jersey for that, mind you.
10 minutes later, the RetroWare TV guys are interviewing me. In front of the Video Game History Museum
sign,
I'm looking
you,
at Mike in the background.
It's not you, Mike. It's me.
It's fine. It was all good.
Dude,
I
said to you there, they get the sort of generic stock stuff. Like, they ask me questions that everybody asks, and I love those guys, and I'm glad that they got some footage, and it's really good for the museum. But, you know, we work together. We're here. We can, you know,
I can give you some sort of scoop.
And if you want to do, you know, something really cool, we can do something exclusive because it's us.
Yeah, I kid.
And so you actually
asked
him, and then suddenly he's very busy that day.
Can't we do it another time?
I'm not feeling.
No, that's not true. I definitely owe you one. I felt bad about that.
No, it's cool. It's cool. But I really enjoyed PAX. It was a good time, and I definitely will be attending more conventions in the future. CGE
Classic Gaming Expo, August 11th, 12th.
Classic Gaming Expo. I will be there with camera in tow. So if any of you out there are going to be going and you see me walking with camera in tow, feel free to say hi. And I'll challenge any of you.
I'm going to put my toes in Mike's camera.
Nice.
If he gets too close. Yeah, I thought PAX was great. It's amazing how, I mean, that's like 70,000 people in one convention center, and the vibe is consistently positive, even in the most confined spaces where there's the most sweaty, smelly people in costumes and, you know, people standing in line for 3 hours to see Assassin's Creed 3 or Borderlands 2, get their hands on a demo of that. And the whole time, people, you know, standing in lines or trying to make their way through crowded, everyone's got a smile on their face. It's the most fun time you can have with that many like-minded people moving through a space like that. It's really cool.
And this is your third year. You've been all three PAX East.
Oh, man. I'm now officially a PAX East super veteran. I mean, we've done it all.
Did you see anything this year that was, like, much different or much improved over the past?
I think, you know, not to toot our own horn, but I think our room saw traffic, the classic console free play room, saw people traffic that
was insane
in comparison to previous years. And I think that's because we were on the same floor as the entrance, and we were right around the corner from where people walk in. So aside from going down into the convention hall, people who came around that corner, we were one of the first rooms that they, as they're going by, even to check their coat or to get their badge, they look
in.
Or
to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, and there's, you know, 50 consoles. And
I knew where the bathroom was. I'm an enforcer, ma'am. Bathroom's over that way.
Yeah, that's what you want to be associated with.
Wash your hands.
That was all I knew.
Yeah, so the traffic in our room was great. As far as the show floor, this year, I said to myself, I'm going to stand in line. I'm going to see something like Assassin's Creed 3. I'm going to see what Rockstar has behind, like, their wall for Max Payne 3. I wanted to see something like that, and then I get down to the convention floor, and I walk around a little, and I'm like, it's not going to be this year. It's just not.
It's not happening.
I can't bring myself to do, even though, you know, we're there as a part of PAX, and we're supporting that whole setup, and I can't bring myself to stand in those lines. I'm like, you know what, I'll see the trailers online, and I'll play the game when it comes out or it has a demo. And I think it's really cool that they bring that stuff there, and people get to see it. Special, but
But it does seem like a thing for young people,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does. Yeah, I mean, I looked at those things too.
You guys know this. I didn't set foot in the main hall for the entire weekend, other than the day that it was being set up.
Not even to enforce.
No, I enforced the outer areas, the more dangerous wasteland of the PAX. But I didn't want anything. I mean, I've been to lots of E3s and I've been to the PAX shows, and I don't want to say that they're all the same, but I don't have that same excitement, like, wow, what's coming out new? Let me get in line. Let me get, you know, I don't mind waiting until it actually comes out. I don't need the preview. I definitely don't need to be rubbing elbows with every single person, you know, in the Boston area.
Wait isn't that long anymore.
You know, I walked through it when they were getting set up. I never saw a complete main show floor, and I was fine with that. There was enough things to do, even outside in the main floor, to keep me busy that I didn't feel like I missed anything, and I certainly caught up with all of it afterwards when the videos and pictures started popping up on the net.
Yeah, I did really enjoy, for the first time this year, more than just Mega 64's discussion panel. I got to see you participate in two really cool discussion panels, one on the preservation of video game media, and the other was the Antiques Roadshow Video Games Edition. Which were really cool.
Yeah, those were fun to do. It was, I was a little nervous about both of them. As you know, we drove up there together, and
I
was kind of concerned.
You never give yourself credit, man. You're such a great public speaker.
I don't mind speaking in public, but I'm always concerned when there's a panel involved that I'm either not going to fit in, or that they know more than I do, or that one of them is going to say something that's going to put me in an embarrassing situation, and I'm not going to be the one to get us out of it. I'm a kind of a control freak. So situations where you're a team like this, you know, speaking can be a little awkward for me. And the guys that I did this with were awesome. I mean, they were so good. So the one we did on Friday morning was about preservation. I was concerned first that nobody was going to show up because it was Friday morning. The show doors had just opened up at 10 o'clock, and we're up there at 11:30 doing a keynote. It's like, who's going to come up here at 11:30 when there's the whole show floor? It would take you way more than an hour and a half just to see it.
Yeah.
But there was a pretty decent turnout.
Oh, yeah.
It was in this giant room, but, you know, I would say there was probably 100 people there, which was, you know, well beyond what I would have expected at that time. And the guys that were, you know, there was Gary Vinson representing ACAM, Rayford Gwynns, if I'm pronouncing his name right, who works with the Smithsonian, and then John, who was doing the actual moderating. These guys all had really, really cool stories to share. So I didn't feel like I was going to be the only guy who's working in a game store talking about how we, you know, protect Nintendo cartridges. These guys had really interesting stories from their walks of life that weren't at all stuffy and were definitely relative to anybody that was there to watch it. You know, so that was really fun.
Yeah, Rayford Gwynns talking about really doing investigative journalism and clarifying some of the stuff about the Atari New Mexico dump. I mean, that's some groundbreaking stuff for people in our hobby.
Yeah.
That stuff that has been the talk of myth and legend for years. The was it Nevada or New Mexico?
New Mexico.
Yeah. The New Mexico, the legendary E.T. dump.
Landfill.
This massive
landfill of
Rayford
E.T. cartridges.
Gwynns, if that's his name, again, I'll share your sentiment.
That's how
we're pronouncing it right.
Yeah.
He's going to be, he said he's putting a book out in 2013 that details this and other things about video game preservation, but he actually went and interviewed the mayor, who was the mayor at the time when the dump happened. He did research as to where the trucks came from. He found individuals that were living in the town still that were there, grew up there.
Right, the security guards
that
monitored
at the dump,
that area.
Yeah. And he definitely found some really legitimate evidence that it wasn't just E.T. cartridges. Atari dumped pretty much all of their existing physical stock in a means to avoid some type of tax penalization for having that much physical merchandise and filing X amount of profits for whatever year that was. And the stuff was basically dumped off of the trucks in complete state in the dump. And the trucks took off back to Sunnyvale or wherever.
And they dug them all up.
Yeah. And, they weren't even buried was
the
thing of it. And the kids that would frequent that garbage dump to find parts for motorcycles and cars suddenly came across mountains of boxed Atari 2600 consoles and that whole run of games from the E.T. era. Not just E.T. He said there was Defenders.
Actually, didn't they say there wasn't an E.T.? I
mean, possibly that was the least of it.
Yeah, none of them actually recall ever seeing an E.T.
Yeah.
of all the stuff that they dug out of there,
but
which is really funny.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating thing, and I encourage you to keep an eye on this whenever he does publish the book, and we should support him by, if he makes it available, a digital version or paperback or whatever, get it. Because it's probably really elaborate, and he seemed really learned and well documented.
Yeah, we're hoping to get him out at CG.
Did he actually manage to track down the kid that might have gone to the dump,
grab
the game, and he still had
it?
No,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes.
That's
really cool.
That's going to be a book that he's writing, or is it? Okay.
Yeah, I think he's done an article.
Not like a film or anything. It's just
it's a book.
Okay, good.
I'm sure
he
could option it as a film. That would be a great...
an interesting read. Kickstarter.
A short film, perhaps.
And I'm sure we'll see a deluge of Atari carts on eBay from the legendary dump.
No, because the thing is, they were eventually, like over the course of a week, I think, he said kids were showing up to pawn shops and pawnbrokers with all this boxed Atari merchandise, and the pawn shops got wise in a minute, and they called the cops and said, where are these kids getting all this stuff?
Yeah.
They must be stealing it, and they traced it back to the dump,
yep.
And then they made the dump contact Atari and get, you know, the facilities down there to crush. Everything was physically demolished and
dust
mixed in with concrete. So it is in a landfill, but it's not, you could never pull it back out. Even if you crack the concrete open, it's going to be particulate matter.
Unless you're very, very persistent, and you have some kind of electron microscope, and you piece it back together.
No, he described it as being dust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
it's pulverized.
Yeah,
but it was the first time that stuff was debunked, and the Antiques Roadshow was fun. We saw some familiar faces up there, and we saw some the actual prototype Earthbound cartridge. We saw an actual prototype, the only existing prototype of BioForce Ape, the real
right.
one. The,
that's right. So Frank Cifaldi, Chris Kohler,
yep.
Steve Lin, and myself were the panel this year. And they do this every year, this Antiques Roadshow type of thing with gaming. But I think this year was more fun than ever. Like I've watched them before, and they're always really interesting, and those guys are very knowledgeable. It was fun to be a part of it this year. And I gave them such a hard time last year about not inviting me on it that I guess maybe it was a guilt thing. In fact, nobody ever told me I was on it. I just saw on the PAX website that I was listed as one of the people.
Well,
like, okay,
I guess I'll be speaking.
I guess
there.
It worked. I guilted them into getting me in there. And dude, one of my top three moments, I told you this, my top three moments of PAX, if not my favorite moment, was as they were going through, you know, various items. It was all, you know, pretty standard and kind of funny because all these guys have interesting personalities. But they got to Popeye Game & Watch. Now, anyone that's there kind of has the idea that some of this stuff is screened in advance. Like, there's no way anybody knows this stuff right off the top of their heads. But some of the items are in advance screen, so you kind of mm-hmm. know what's coming. And then it's up to you. Like, you can talk amongst ourselves. We can try to figure it out. So I knew somebody, it was written on an iPad, Popeye Game & Watch. I'm like, my boy Frankie's a Game & Watch guy. Yeah. Like, I know he's going to know how much this is worth. So I'm like, how much is the Popeye Game & Watch? And I forget. You were like, well, you know, the little
wide
screen is black
and
white.
Yeah.
That's the one I thought it was, too.
About $50 loose.
So I'm like, okay, good. That's all I need. I own one, so I know what it's supposed to look like and what. So, of course, the guy comes up, and it's not that one. It's the tabletop one, which is this big green, you know, thing. I'm like, okay, well, that I have, but I have no clue.
And I'm in the audience, front row, miming to Joe, like, no, it's not the small one. That's the big one. It's not $50.
And, of course, we were on the same page because I'm looking at you so that you know that I know that's not the same thing. So I'm waiting for him to flash me like it's $150-something, but nothing, right? So inevitably, the conversation comes back around to me, and somebody had quoted, I think Steve Lin had quoted the guy about $100. And they're like, well, Joe, you know, you probably get these into your store. What do you think? And I'm like, you know what? I'd like to call in a friend of mine who's an expert on these things.
It was
and
the Pawn
so
Stars moment.
I'm able to actually say that in this situation where it actually mattered. And he's sitting up in the front. I'm like, Frankie, could
I'd
you
like
come
over? Use a lifeline.
So it was exactly like if you were watching Pawn Stars, except without the big straw hat.
Yeah.
Right.
I did have the big Amish beard, though, because I had cosplayed that day. During the show, I was walking around like a character from Full Metal Alchemist that happened to not have a mustache but a big beard. So all I needed was that straw hat, and I would have looked just like that museum historian that always gets called in on Pawn Stars. But yeah, I mean, Steve was right on the money, but I elaborated in a way that explained a little bit more about the game, that Game & Watch, and why those are worth, you know, a little bit more desirable than some of the widescreen, the little pocket ones. But yeah, it was great. It was a great moment.
It was fun. Fun improv.
Lightning in a bottle at PAX. That's what that moment
was.
And
for you kids waiting out there, we do have footage of Frankie in said outfit dancing.
Uh-oh.
That will be put right about now.
Da-di-da, da-di-da, da-da. Da-di-da, da-di-da, da-da. Da-di-da, da-di-da, da-da. Da-di-da-da-di-da-da. Da-da-dum.
Oh, God, look at him. Oh, make it stop, Mike.
Here, let's... This is the outfit that Jessica Negri got kicked out of... Well, not kicked out officially.
You need to change that. It's very, very distracting.
I know, I've had this...
I keep looking over.
I'm sitting
like
there. It's like right there the whole entire time
God.
We're having this conversation.
Frank has been saving it to his favorites.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to zoom in. All right,
right.
I don't know
that's
if that's
his new background.
Work.
Well, you can pull up...
I can get an image. I'll put an image.
But, yeah, it was really revealing.
Email me this image.
You could just search for it on the internet. It's like people have shrines to it already, I think. I mean, she looked...
Dude, don't make it your background.
She looked great. And I, you know, what's interesting is that outfit is actually in the game. It's like an alternate costume. And the first day she had the cheerleader outfit on, and she was walking around, and that apparently wasn't a problem. But as soon as she had the revealing low cut that, I mean, almost comes down to the bikini line... I can understand how the PAX, which is, it is a family show.
I can't understand that. That should be allowed. More women should be doing it. come to Digital Press if Video Games dressed in cosplay, ladies.
Mike, you have to understand. It's so graphic violence all over the place, zombies, that's
cool.
Yeah,
it's all good. Killing.
Can't have sex.
Well, you know what's funny, actually?
It's not natural.
There was a quick story, and I'll digress real quick here. There was some kids that, you know, come to our gaming center in the back, and they're constantly playing, like, your first-person shooter games. And these kids are, like, 10 and 12. And the parents have, you know, given us
and they're probably on Xbox Live.
You know, everything's cool, and they're, you know, they come in and play and whatnot. And I give them a little grief here and there because, you know, my days are long and boring here. But, so one day I was like, you know what? I'm like, you should play
That's
a real game.
You say while the boss is around.
I'm like, you should play a real game, not a first-person shooter. Get yourself, like, a fighting game. And literally, it was like BlazBlue, and the one boy is like, I can't play this because the character has breasts. And I'm like, so your mom's okay with you taking a gun and killing people with, you know? And he was like, yeah, that's fine, but I can't play the game with breasts. So breasts are scary, apparently, to young gamers.
Well, you must have seen that before in here with parents. Like, the swearing and the sex is way worse than the violence. Yeah. Like, they just come to expect violence with video games. But
breasts,
the other stuff is
what's
adulthood.
Wrong with this country nowadays.
It is.
That's why we're
damn
in a
you girls and your breasts.
Breasts.
Is it?
Probably.
Well, then I hope that recession lasts forever.
Best recession
and just real
ever.
Real quick, before I forget, too. The reason why we're involved with PAX East in the first place is because we bring Digital Press originally brings all the game systems and the games that are used in the classic consoles free play area, which is essentially like a gigantic NAVA. To anyone that's come to one of our local events, you come, we set up game systems for free, you pick the games that you want to play, and you kind of hang out and, you know,
and I'm there
and
playing
enjoy.
Saturday Night Slam Masters.
And then Frankie challenges anyone to take him on in his favorite wrestling game.
Very
he lost several times
year?
During that weekend. It wasn't
yeah.
a good weekend for Frankie.
I made a mistake of picking up a third-party controller.
Lies.
Yeah, it was bad.
Real gamers can
Sick
play
controller.
With any kind of controls. That's all I have to
but
say.
But this year we went a step further. So besides Digital Press just supplying the games and the systems, we also brought Video Game History Museum stuff out there. Set up a couple tables, some banners, some literature, and kind of let people get a sample of what video game history might be if it ever were to exist someday in physical form. So, and that went over really well. We met some cool industry people that were very excited about what we were doing. It was fun spending some time just kind of hanging around there and listening to what people had to say. I think we made a pretty good impression and probably got some nice notoriety that we wouldn't have ordinarily to a crowd that wouldn't have known we existed otherwise. So, it's a good time.
We did manage to get that interview in there. If you guys want to see
it. And we got
a
RetroWare TV plug spot, which we definitely need to watch. I haven't seen that yet.
For all of you out there, all three of you, RetroWareTV.com. It's
you and Mike or something.
Good? Any final comments on PAX? PAX 2013?
I will definitely be at PAX 2013, and actually, I might even be at. There's a PAX West, right? Like a PAX.
They're PAX Prime.
Yeah.
I call that.
Okay, PAX
Seattle.
Prime.
Seattle.
Seattle. I might be eventually out that way, so.
I actually.
I might be there with camera in tow.
Regarding your game preservation panel, did you guys touch upon digital content and how that might be preserved at all?
Yep. They did.
That's something I'd like to hear about. Any thoughts?
I remember some of the discussion.
I that's not my area for sure, but it did come up.
For the upcoming generation.
Well, they said that a lot of the guy who ran the panel, Chris
John Anderson.
Sorry, John Anderson. He
Mr. Anderson.
He had interviewed a lot of classic game developers from the 80s. Most of the Japanese ones were the ones that were willing to discuss what their archival stuff was for their early game ROMs, and a lot of them no longer have anything because it was kind of like pulp art in the 1940s. It was produced for entertainment purposes and then not archived. It just, there was no thought of it ever being reusable, emulatable, whatever. It was,
of course,
kind of, it went away. But jumping ahead to modern times, a lot of the indie developers that are doing stuff that's specifically available on Steam or iOS or Android Store. I mean, they have their own personal backups, but they're not archiving for history's sake. They say if Steam Cloud goes away,
that's it.
We hope somebody else has backed it up. Like, it's really, you know, and a lot of them may not be, you know, they may be industry people, they may be game developers, but not everybody is history-minded. Not everybody is archiving for the sake of archiving. It's
right.
It's an interesting... You have to be of that mindset. You want your stuff to be available in the future, and you're depending on other people's technology.
But there are... You did hear also that there are collaborations in the works now among these various archivists and museum creators that, you know, there's a network that's being formed where... Who's going to take charge of what? Who's got what? Who, you know, where is there overlap? Where is there gaps like this that, you know, are, that need to be filled? And who's going to step up and pick it? So it's, at least it's knowledge now. Like it's out there that this stuff needs to
Someone's
be preserved.
Thinking about it.
Yeah.
There's they're activists essentially. Yeah. They're going to spread the word of what, you know, this stuff needs to be archived for the future because, I mean, essentially there are things, thanks to the community that has done things like dumped boards and backed up ROMs and backed up floppies that still exist today that in some catastrophic incident could have gone away permanently. I can't personally think of any specific game that no longer exists based on loss of...
Bastion 2.
Yeah, that was our future. That's been the future there.
I see that more of being a big concern, more for... at least Xbox Live Arcade games and PSN games, because on the PC, there's always a way around things like that. Someone can have a backup somewhere. There's even an entire website. I think it's called Abandonia. That's dedicated. Yeah, it's dedicated specifically to like 80s games that were on floppy, like you mentioned. On the PC, it's much easier for someone to make a backup. But when it comes to like the 360, let's say two generations from now, are they really still going to have
Never
that on
fear.
The Xbox Live?
Pirates got you covered there.
They've already had it. Pretty,
Yeah, pirates, sure.
Mike's got all that.
Mike is single-handedly archiving everything.
Yeah, pirates, sure, but it's not as easy to get it off the system as it is
Hard drives against the wall.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a concern, and hopefully companies like Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo who have stuff that is only available through digital channels, and Steam and Apple and Android, are taking that into consideration or making some kind of archives, hard data, for the future.
And it sounds like it's underway. Or at least there are people who are willing to take it up, which is good news for everyone.
Maybe those video game history museum guys will take care of it.
What was really fascinating about that first preservation speech, and I've spoken to multiple people since we got back from PAX, that I really, you know, it's one of those stop and smell the roses kind of things. Cathode ray tube monitors, what exists now is pretty much all that is going to be available. The manufacturing on them is so low right now and is available in such a small area of the world where environmental protection is not such that you can manufacture something with that much lead in it. I believe like Hong Kong or certain areas of Asia can still make them, but they're not producing them in the correct scale for arcade machines anymore. So in 50 years from now, when as much repair work that could possibly be done to the existing ones, if they can be recapped, degaussed, whatever, eventually the electrons on those are going to stop functioning, the tubes are going to burn out, and then that's it. Yep. The only option that people will have at that point in time is to convert cabinets to some kind of flat screen display, which is never going to look exactly the same. I mean,
there are products though, even for the home, like the XRGB3, which is from Japan, that you can take your old any system that has like a, you know, like a RGB input or composite S-video and component as well. There's some component, you know, and you can display them on LCD screens and put like
scan lines.
But it's a simulated technology. It's not like it doesn't actually.
It comes close, but the thing about it is that they're very expensive.
But that's the point. That's
so
the
niche.
Point, though.
Right.
Close,
so niche.
Close is never going to be able to physically.
Yeah, there was a whole subtopic about emulate. You know, Gary brought that up because I mean, we know you see Dragon's Lair. You know, it's not running on the actual hardware. It's as close as you can get, and it's very hard to detect. But it isn't the actual, and people who are real purists can spot those little things that make it different.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the issue 50 years from now,
He's
like you said.
There
will be a day when you know somebody will be like, that's not what it was. You know, it's not. It looks like it, but it isn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Actually, it's funny you bring up emulation, because there is now a Super Nintendo emulator that is very accurate to the hardware. but it requires a very powerful computer to run. Mm-hmm. Just because getting all that code to work properly requires at least a 3 gigahertz processor. I remember reading, really?
Well, that's today, though, yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, remember early emulators on computers? I remember when Activision did their first set. Like, you needed a pretty good computer to run Pitfall on your, you know, on a tiny little screen within Windows.
Oh yeah.
You know, things catch up, and
eventually
those things will ultimately be doable.
That power is just exponentially getting better and better in computers, so eventually.
And also, the coding will become more.
But
efficient.
It's still emulation. Yeah.
And so stop and smell those roses and play.
Save everything.
Play an arcade cabinet that has an original tube monitor in it when you see it.
And as I've said for 20 years now, don't ever throw anything out, ever, no matter what it is.
This week on Quarters, Joe Santulli. Atari cartridges everywhere.
That old 17-inch black and white television. All right, we're good, right?
Yeah. We're good, Chris.
Hi, I'm Frankie Vitarello. We're here with the Digital Press Podcast, a very special interview with Mr. Rob Jaeger, the original programmer and designer of Montezuma's Revenge for the Atari 8-bit systems and many other systems that came afterwards. And he's stopped by the Digital Press store for a NAVA event, and he's been good enough to sit down with us for a few minutes and answer a few of our questions. Thanks for stopping by, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
So, what was your inspiration for Montezuma's Revenge?
Well, Montezuma's Revenge had many things about it that were very original, but certainly I was inspired by Donkey Kong, some of the older 2600 adventure games, like if you remember Superman.
Oh yeah, classic.
Where you have to find pieces of the bridge, put it together. I like the idea of having a wide, non-linear type game, and I combined elements of the platformers, of the Donkey Kong, with the elements of the adventure, and just tried to put it together in a harmonious way.
Excellent. We see in the splash screen for the Atari 8-bit version, Mark Sunshine is credited. Can you tell us about Mark Sunshine?
Mark is a great friend of mine. We've been friends since we were about 13 years old. And at the time, I believe it was after I did Pinhead, I just didn't know what to do next. And I was sitting down with Mark, and we were just brainstorming. And Mark said, hey, why don't you make an Aztec-themed game and call it Montezuma's Revenge? And I'm like, that's a good idea. let's do that. That's fun. Mark is a super talented guy. He's a singer and a songwriter. He's not a programmer, but he certainly is super, super creative.
But he's part of the brain trust of Montezuma.
And he is credited on the original version. Most of the Parker Brothers versions, I think actually all of them didn't have any credits at all. But I told him he'd be credited, and whenever I would be credited, and the new version for the iPhone and the iPad has his name as the credit, along with the programmer of that version.
So for those of you who have seen that name on the splash screen and have looked through your encyclopedias of video game production and never was able to find Mark Sunshine, we've broken the mystery on the Digital Press Podcast.
Well, he's also the singer for a rock band called Riot God. Getting a lot of publicity lately.
Check them out.
They're really good.
How long did it take to produce Montezuma's Revenge, your original cut of Montezuma's Revenge?
I think I worked probably about 8 months on it, but those were serious, 16-hour days. I really, really worked like crazy.
That was typical of, Atari development at the time, if you're developing a game. It was all you, right? You were just sitting.
Yeah, I did everything, the graphics, the music, the level design, just everything. But it wasn't that unusual for, back then, for one person to create the whole game from scratch.
8 months, wow. And what was the decision to use the Herb Alpert the theme from Dating Game?
Yeah, that was a mistake. that never made it into the official release.
That
version.
Was not the official release.
The version you're talking about was the preliminary, the one that got leaked basically that never was intended to be in the public, but it is the version that people remember most. And I didn't even, you know, I at the time, I mean, I was 15 years old. I didn't realize that it was, you know, that it was. I thought it was an old time song, you know, from the old days.
Standard. I mean, it's become a standard, and it's great. It's catchy. Everybody knows it. Everybody loves that one.
But I believe it's what Spanish flea.
Yes.
So that was the, you know, the Spanish. And the
so there was a connection, a correlation to the whole Aztec and thing. Hey, I love it. I love that song. Once you get it stuck in your head, you can't stop whistling it. So there's a new version of Montezuma's Revenge on iOS that is not strictly a new version. You actually discovered it, and there's a story behind
Yes. It. Yeah, there is an interesting story behind it. Back in December, a few fans of the original game contacted me on Facebook and said, hey, there's a clone out there. And I wasn't that shocked, you know, because there have been other clones or games that were inspired by Montezuma. And the truth is, you know, I'm sometimes flattered if someone makes a game that, you know, is inspired by my game. But the guys were saying this is a clone, and it's a really good clone.
It's
a really, really, really good clone. So I had to take a look at it, and it was really good. Now the programmer who created it, Jim Pavlov, he was really just a huge fan of the game. And even in his description of it, he says, a tribute to the original by Robert Jager, puts my name there in the info page and everything. He's not hiding. He's not trying to do anything. So I saw how good it was, and I contacted him. I said, let's talk. And he's like, oh, I can't believe it's you. Like, I'm still on. And it's like, first thing he said to me, if you'd like me to take it off the market, I will tomorrow. I'm like, well, it's okay. Let's you and I should have a little talk, and maybe we can make something happen here. I told him I want this game. I want him to modify it a little bit and make this the official version, the official iPhone, iPad version of the game. It's something that I've actually been thinking about a long time. I never really had the time to program it, and just it coincided in a way where this young guy in Ukraine, he just did a spectacular job. I don't know if I could have done better myself doing this. I mean, he really did a beautiful job. He updated the graphics, and he included my original graphics. So you have a choice of playing with the original graphics that you remember and love from the Atari, and you could play with updated, better, much, you know, more high-res versions of the graphics. But still, what he did was he kept the gameplay. I mean, he kept the fun, the exact what do you call it? The ratio, how Pedro, the character moves is exactly the same as the way you remember.
Pedro,
so
some of you may know him as Panama Joe,
yes,
or Panama Jack, depending on where we are in the history of the licensing and the development of the game.
Yes, the character was originally Pedro, and he's Pedro again. So that
he's returned
is
to his roots.
He's returned to his roots.
He's no longer in the witness protection program.
Exactly. He used an alias for a while of Panama Jack and then Panama Joe, but now he's Pedro.
But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about as far as the play mechanics go. We've been playing it at NAVA today here at the Digital Press Store, side by side, right with an original Atari 8-bit version, actually the original version that you programmed. And it, you know, the movement, the mechanics, for it being an iOS game, it's pretty much beat for beat. It has graphical updates, but I mean, if you remember playing it on your 2600 or your Atari 8-bit or your 5200 or your Coleco, you're gonna have the same level of frustration. You're gonna wanna, you know, strangle your screen every once in a while. But it's also that same fun and compelling adventure game that it was back in the day. Mm-hmm. So check it out on iOS. It's available right now. I believe it's $1.99.
That's correct.
On the iOS, on the App Store. What was your inspiration for becoming a programmer? I mean, was it something that you always wanted to do? Or
I knew when I was about 9 or 10 years old that I was going to make video games. So that's all I wanted to do. I started off I'm very lucky to have seen the whole evolution of video games, you know, from Pong onward. And I started off with a great love for pinball. You know, the arcades, to me, was the most exciting thing in the world, going to the arcades. And then when the video game revolution happened, that was just amazing, because if you were around in the late 70s, early 80s, the Atari games, every time you would go to the arcade, every month, there would be a new game.
Oh, yeah.
And it was totally new, totally, a whole new genre, completely different from anything you've ever seen before. And you can just watch someone play, and then you can play. Like, you know, yeah. You know, it was just, you can just...
A lot of people now in this modern era where everything is fed to us through the internet, where we get pre-release press, we get stuff, you know, a year before a game is even released, and maybe 2 years, we get development diaries, we get pre-production. But back in the 70s and 80s, when you're part of an arcade culture, you know, even if you subscribed to gaming publications, sometimes you'd walk in and there'd be a new machine that you knew nothing about. Maybe it came from Japan or, you know, from somewhere, and it was completely fresh and new. There's a certain magic.
Yeah, it was. So,
it doesn't
was,
exist anymore.
It was so exciting. And then I guess when I was probably about 10 years old, I learned that this is computers. These machines are, in fact, computers, and you have to be a computer programmer if you want to make these games. So I just took it, you know, I just said, I got to study, you know, computer science at a time when there were hardly, you know, any books. You know, it was very, very difficult to find, I mean, forget about the internet, I didn't know it was going to be around for another 20 years more or less at that point. But the, there were just hardly any books published on the type of programming that you needed to know to make
games.
So you're
largely self-taught at that point?
Yeah. I started with BASIC, like most people did, and I was very lucky that my family was able to afford and get the Bally Astrocade, which is the machine I wanted, because it had a BASIC cartridge. It had BASIC programming in it, where the other ones didn't. I think eventually there was a BASIC cartridge for the Atari. Yeah. It wasn't nearly as good. It wasn't the Astrocade. The Bally Astrocade had a cassette interface, and it had a BASIC cartridge, and that's really all you needed to get started learning programming.
Mike's a big Bally Astrocade fan. Our one of our podcasters he sings the song of Bally Astrocade quite frequently, and we.
It was so ahead of its time and so underappreciated. It never was a big success. You know,
yeah.
I was the only one who had one.
It was.
Everyone had the 2600.
Yep.
Which was also a great game machine, but you couldn't program on it.
So, what are you working on now?
Well, I work for a company called Poker Tracker, which is analytical software for poker players. People say, well, you know, are you still in games? And I say, well, I am, but I mean, like adult games. After Montezuma,
You say adult games, you don't mean like Custer's Revenge.
No, but really, after Montezuma, I did go to adult games. Nothing X-rated or anything like that. For a while, I created coin-operated games that worked in, you know, bar top, countertop games that were pretty much for adults in bars.
Yeah, that's big.
Touchscreen
business, yeah.
Stuff, and my company had a very popular coin-op game. But also, I took my computer science career over to Wall Street, which is also, you know, gaming, money games, and also to poker. And the work that I do for Poker Tracker is very graphic intensive and very, it's very analytical. It's very difficult computer programming, but it's a related field.
Right.
But I still love games, and now that Montezuma is out for the iPhone, there's a tremendous demand for the Android. And I really, really want to do some things, do an Android version of Montezuma, and also possibly something new in that style, in the style of the old games.
I think there's a new renaissance of classic 2D adventure gaming or retro adventure gaming, whatever you want to call it. There's a new appreciation, even in a new generation that spent so much time with high-definition, three-dimensional, polygonal gaming. They're starting to see an appreciation for, you know, the basic mechanics of, no matter how beautiful anything is, if it doesn't play in a way that is rudimentary and functional,
Absolutely.
I hope to speak on behalf of the entire gaming community and ask you to please, you know, go forward with that.
That was the spirit of the old games. It was fun. Like, the fun was the core. That was the thing. And fun can be created in many, many, many different ways. And in a way, because we were limited with graphics, the games were better in a sense, because now the hardware, the technology has gotten so ahead of itself that people are focusing on, okay, we have to beat that last technical hurdle.
Yep.
So the focus is on the technology rather than the fun. Or, you know, figuring out how many polygons we could pump, or you know, how we could take advantage of this next higher resolution. Where back in the older days, when we had a wall, we knew the maximum we can do. It was a challenge to get as much fun into that restriction as possible.
Right.
So the games were just more fun. And also, of course, easier to pick up and play.
Right.
Which is a key thing, too. Because I don't have time. Like, I just don't have the time to read the, you know, just to dedicate a few hours into learning a game. I really want to play.
There's no tutorial level in Montezuma's Revenge. You know when you start, you know, what you need to do.
You know what to do. You can watch, well, with the preliminary version, you can watch the track mode, and you can see, you know, you can just see what needs to be done. It's very easy. It's like most of the games of the time, super easy to learn. In fact, no learning curve, but really hard to master. You know, you really... There was a tremendous value there where you were able to, you know, play for many, 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 many hours, see more to it, and get and master the game. And it was a tremendous feeling of satisfaction.
I played Montezuma's Revenge for many, many, many hours, and still to this day I have not completed it, but it's now a goal of mine. And I will, on iOS, I'll throw the gauntlet down again, and I'll see if I can take my revenge on Montezuma.
All right.
Thank you for visiting us at NAVA. Thank you,
Frankie. Thanks for having me here. I had a good time today.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we're back with the Digital Press Podcast from the future. What episode is it?
7.
Thank you.
10-2.
Never live it down.
7-2. It actually is, really. 7-2. You'll never know.
We lost, an episode fell into a black hole, actually. It was...
technical issues.
It was an ace of a hole.
Convoluted backstory.
Ejected into space. It went up as part of NASA's last shuttle launch.
What are you trying to say, man?
Anything.
Get to it. All right. What are we up to now? What are we talking about in this new segment?
More talk about the next generation of consoles. This kind of chatter is never going to end until we get some specs, some real specs, and we're coming up on E3, so...
E3, another convention.
Yep, that we're going to hear some stuff from. What have you guys heard?
Well, some of the big rumors have to do with the format, the game format, the media that these things are going to use. Lately, there's been talk, you know, the knee-jerk initial reaction is, obviously everything's going to be Blu-ray. Right, but now all of a sudden people are starting to talk about, you know, will the next Xbox not have any disc drive at all? You know, because there's always, no matter what, I mean, for the past, like, you know, few years, the talk of things going all digital has been sort of the elephant in the room, you know. And
the 800-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
In the room.
Everyone keeps talking about it as, you know, like, oh, it's inevitable, and then everyone keeps talking about, well, is it going to happen now? Is it going to happen later?
There will be a revolt.
Absolutely
not.
And then
happen
you will
right all succumb.
You know,
absolutely
like
not. No. It's not going to happen right now, and not even anytime soon. 100% because the broadband infrastructure in this country just will not support that system in a way that will be profitable to developers, publishers, and Microsoft and Sony. We're just not there yet. We're just not there yet. And even the people that do have broadband, they don't necessarily have the speed to download high-definition games. There are a majority of people who are on ISPs that have download caps.
Comcast. Which is common in this area.
The number one ISP in the country, and they have a very restrictive cap. We're just not there yet for digital distribution.
You know, what I love, and I don't I don't disagree with you, but I love it when I get into this conversation with people and there's always that standard response, well, there's so many people that don't have internet. It's like, I can't think of a single person in that I know anywhere, even people I've casually interacted with, that don't have internet and, you know, every member of their family has a smartphone. And I mean, like, I really think that regardless of what any statistics say, internet is prevalent, like, in every major household. Cable companies make it a part of
basic
services.
It is, but there's different factors. More toward the, a lot of the rural areas don't have fast broadband.
Right.
There's a base definition of broadband, and some of them barely make it. Like, a 1.5 megabit download is what the FCC considers broadband.
Is that low DSL, way too slow
to download a 50 gig title. Way too slow. It'll take hours. And not only that, but there are still a lot of dial-up users in the country, mostly toward the Midwestern region where the infrastructure, again, it's just not there yet. In this part of the country, we're in the Northeast, yes, everyone has broadband. And a lot of people have fast broadband. But there's still that other huge part of the country that it's just not there yet. And that's actually one of the...
They leave them in the past.
Yes.
Even disregarding
wagons.
Even assuming, let's say everyone in the country did have fast broadband, is it worth putting all your eggs in that basket if you're Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo when all of a sudden, if, you know, because the thing is, people can't choose. People have very little, very small leeway with who provides their internet as far as, you know, cable
mm-hmm.
providers. You can't pick your cable provider. You have, you know, cable, maybe satellite. Some people use that for the internet.
Maybe
BIOS.
So if you're lucky.
It's gotten better.
Yeah.
It has gotten better in terms of choices.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you're still
limited to like
still
two
limited.
Or three. You're
so
not. You don't have like.
Yeah, you can't choose between two different cable companies.
You can't go to like
exactly.
Burger King,
yeah.
McDonald's, Wendy's,
yeah.
Five
so what
Guys,
that means,
Chick-fil-A.
You hungry?
No, actually, really not.
So, I mean, if your customers are limited like that. If you're Microsoft or whatever, your customers are limited. What happens if all of a sudden Comcast decides to really step it up? Because what's going to happen if Comcast notices half their customers are now doing 100 gig downloads a month, you know, and stuff like that? What's going to happen if all of a sudden they start charging extra?
They,
or, you know,
actually, they can. They can handle it. It's just that they're taking advantage of the fact that a lot of the average person doesn't know that their operating costs have gone astronomically low, but their profits have risen astronomically high. The data cap that they have is an artificial one. Their infrastructure can absolutely support all this exchange of information that's going around. But
are they willing to, though?
They're not willing. That's the thing. And there's a huge movement. It's called net neutrality. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do a whole thing where, all right, you pay for how much internet usage you use, you know, instead of just a standard flat rate that we're all used to at this point. But there, like I said, there is a huge movement that's saying, no, net neutrality has to stay the same. No ISP should have data caps. Mm-hmm. Prices should be the same for everyone. And there's a controversy right now, especially with Comcast, that you bring them up. They have Netflix counts against your cap. Right, so if you watch a couple of high-def movies a week, you're getting close to hitting that cap. They offer their own service called Xfinity.
I know where this is
That's
going.
A streaming service. You can stream movies, you can stream TV shows. Mm-hmm. It does not count against your cap,
mm-hmm.
and it's Comcast's own proprietary service. Their claim is that, well, it's not coming across the internet. It's coming across our own internal network
now,
that we send to your
you
house.
Can you use Netflix on an Xbox 360 that is a Xfinity approved device and it doesn't count, but if you use Netflix on your laptop that is connected to standard internet via that service, it does count? I saw something equivalent to that online, and that is a part of the whole net neutrality argument. I apologize if I'm misrepresenting the scenario, but that's essentially what I saw as the big red herring of this Xfinity service, is that like you can use the same service on an Xfinity-enabled device like an Xbox 360 that has the Xfinity service, and or that maybe the same movie through Xfinity.
Yes, mm-hmm. You're thinking of actually the Netflix CEO recently posted
he's actually
a member of Comcast, which I thought was incredibly ironic that his own ISP mm-hmm. is Comcast.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying, I watched a TV show or whatever it was on Netflix, and it counted against my bill. I later watched it on Xfinity, yeah. and it did not count yeah. on the same device.
Same movie, same
I mean,
device.
The transparency yeah. is obviously something that the general customer doesn't understand.
Right.
I mean, and this goes back, you know, all the way to the original copper cable internet. You know, it's the copper cable cable yeah. and original dial-up internet.
It's the same thing in the mobile space too. Yeah, we have those data caps on mobile data.
The companies
which
dictate
don't need to be
these
there.
Things based mm-hmm. on what works for them in terms of making profit and signing people up and making services appealing and packages appealing, and it just gets to a point where, you know, how do these web companies grow their profits when everything is so baseline? They have to expand the services they offer, or like give you more channels on the cable company's
yeah.
thing. It's complicated, mm-hmm. and it's like a they dig their own grave sort of with the setting everything up like this from the beginning. It doesn't leave them a tremendous amount of room for growth, and then people see through it all when a service like Netflix comes along and offers, you know, all this content, you know. Streaming and whatnot, and it's like you're paying $2 for a movie on demand on Comcast, and then you got like, you know, for $8 a month, you've got thousands of movies. It's like, you know, geez, the bang for my buck or my value proposition
yeah.
is
cable cutting
super low for my cable company.
Yeah,
why?
That's why they call it cable cutting.
Yeah, it's crazy. I know a lot of people that literally dropped their cable completely. Because
of Netflix.
Yeah, they have their internet and they stream everything. They get their TV shows and hey, what happened here?
Needs an update.
Wow, that's a scary world of technology. Future technology we live in. When arcade cabinets are saying they need an update. But I have a lot of friends that have literally dropped cable completely because of what is available, the convenience of the internet. Services like Amazon Prime, Hulu, Netflix, all offer television programs that they enjoy. The serialized shows like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Walking Dead and
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks. Talking about stuff in the past. That's anything with Kyle MacLachlan is cool.
And to bring this back into video game.
Yes.
Discussion.
But that's
Amazon
why we
Prime
won't go.
Is now available for PlayStation 3.
Yes.
First on Sony's PlayStation 3. So, sorry, I just
for all 10 of us out there that have it.
I know. I have it.
I
haven't watched anything. I
love it.
I downloaded the
Joe
app
has it.
And I haven't watched anything
yet. I watched a few minutes of one film.
Have you?
The quality didn't seem to be as good as what Netflix puts out on the consoles.
Oh yeah.
Did you give it time to buffer?
Yes.
What did you download? Like, what did you
tried specifically. I was going through the new release list.
Okay.
And they had Hobo with a Shotgun.
Hobo with a Shotgun.
Wrecker Hour.
Yes.
All right.
Really?
Which I have.
I gotta check it.
Oh,
out.
It's awesome.
I gotta.
I have
it.
I have it on Blu-ray, and I figured that would be a good test because it's a grindhouse sort of film.
Okay.
And it just has like a good color palette to really compare what the HD would be like.
Yeah.
So I figured, all right, I'll try this out, and I also wanted to see what it looks like versus my Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And it looked good. It was definitely high def. You just could tell there was some compression, and the sound didn't seem to be as good as what I normally get out of something from Netflix.
The great thing about that movie, Hobo with a Shotgun, is that when somebody asks you what it's about, you can just say it's about a hobo
yeah,
with a shotgun.
Yes.
Oh, there's the title.
That's pretty
the title says it all.
Yeah. And
Salvage
it has
Planet,
Rucker
sorry.
Hauer, which, mm-hmm. you know.
That's all you need.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
Rucker Hauer. Is it new? Is it like
yeah.
Yeah, it came out last year, I think.
All right. Rucker Hauer. He's my, he's one of my heroes.
More
you guys see The Hitcher on a side note?
Yep.
Hitcher's awesome. Watch The Hitcher.
Blind Fury.
Yes.
Blind Fury. That's a good one.
Which was kind of like Zatoichi, you know, Americanized Zatoichi.
Right,
which actually,
maybe I should
go
for my license.
The Hunger Games can be considered an Americanized version of Battle Royale. I'm just throwing it out there. But
Running Man did it first.
Yeah, but it's different. Running Man wasn't quite the same.
The circumstances are different, but you could make the same
it's
argument
the same,
for Hunger
but,
Games.
But then,
and
but then
and
you
could
say
right
that you could say Death
yeah.
Race
yeah.
with
yeah.
with what's his name?
David Carradine?
No, the original was like
Sylvester Stallone and David Carradine.
Was it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's a Roger Corman classic.
Yes, classic.
Frankenstein.
Yes.
The best line in Death Race 2000, the Roger Corman one, not the one with Jason Statham.
The original.
Death 1978.
I think it was just called Death Race, wasn't it?
No, Death Race 2000.
It was 2000, okay.
The new one with Jason Statham that was directed by Paul W.S. Anderson of Resident Evil movie fame. That one was not called Death Race 2000.
Okay.
But the original 78 one, David Carradine plays Frankenstein. He starts the race and immediately backs his car over his pit crew, and the kind of commentator guy who has the huge 1970s butterfly lapel and the like hair with the sideburns that completely covers ears, he goes, "Jesus Chrysler, Frankenstein just ran over his own pit crew. Can he do that?" That's like my favorite line from that film. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's on Netflix, yes.
And that apparently will go against your cap on Comcast if you watch.
No,
speaking
actually,
of,
they have a special deal.
Speaking of, we should get back to that.
Yeah. It doesn't count on the cap.
Well, it should be, because that movie's a classic. But anyway,
I think we should get back to that.
I basically think that, to sum up my thoughts, is that unless Microsoft and Sony and Nintendo can somehow navigate these channels and get something worked out, that they'd be loath to... Because right now, they're... You know, the digital content is a part of their...
It's a supplementary
income.
Yeah.
I think they'd be loath to basically allow Comcast or any ISP to grab them by
Correct.
The balls and
well,
just straitjacket them, you know, with some unexpected, you
right.
know, all of a sudden, halfway through a console
yeah.
generation...
Don't limit our customers.
Yeah, halfway
I mean,
through a console generation,
kind of
Comcast does something, and all of a sudden, half of New Jersey is no longer capable of... You know,
well, you can see though that Microsoft.
They want,
it seems though that Microsoft is kind of trying to position themselves into a profitable, advantageous relationship with Comcast, Xfinity on the 360. So they have reached out to them. Now, I don't think digital distribution is going to be this generation. Maybe the next one or the one after that. Now, the bigger question is, will the 360 have a disk drive? And if it does, will it be proprietary or Blu-ray? And if not, my guess,
the new Xbox.
Correct, the new one. If they
or
don't, right, and if they don't go with a disk drive, my thinking is that they're going to go with a flash-based typed memory.
Kind of like the,
Vita and the 3DS. And the reason I think they should go this route, I think this would be even more advantageous, is because flash-based memory is getting cheaper as time goes on, much like CD did, and. Not only that, but they wouldn't be limited to a set amount of data you can have on a flash card. You know, with Blu-ray, it's 50 gigs per disc.
Well,
and
100 if you do dual layer.
No, dual layer is 50.
No, dual layer is the 50 gigs.
But didn't they come up with something that's
There's
100?
A triple layer.
Okay.
But your system would have to support it. That would be the next gen of Blu-ray.
Okay.
That would make it a more expensive system. If they went with a flash-based storage, on the other hand, they have expandability. The game could be the exact amount it needs to be. And costs will go down as the generation goes along.
Yeah.
That, to me, seems like it would probably be the more advantageous move.
You know, the one thing about this that makes me really wonder if they wouldn't go for Blu-ray is that the last... I mean, to a point, the original Xbox, a little bit, but mostly for the 360, Microsoft was positioning that console as sort of the center of the living room, the media center.
Correct.
And Sony did the same thing with the PS3. The idea that we know it's not true, but like, you know, that, but they seem to position it as like you can throw out all the electronics you have, you can have a TV and a 360, and you're set. You're done. That's how they wanted to position it. I mean, we know that's a fantasy. You know, it's, I mean, like when you're looking through, you know, a home and garden magazine and see all the appliances in the kitchen are, you know, a Kenmore.
Well,
you know,
it depends on your needs.
Yeah. But, I mean, most people probably have at least a couple of things, different things hooked up to one, you know, TV.
Well, guys like us.
Yeah.
Guys like us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think there are a lot of people that the Xbox or the PS3 is the center of their living room because, like we were just talking about, Netflix now has just become so ubiquitous that you don't even need Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm. Now, but here's the thing, though. If they were going to continue with that and say, okay, this is going to be the media center,
Correct.
All your needs in this one machine...
Except for Blu-ray.
That's the problem. Because now what you're doing is now how do you angle it as a media center but not have it support the primary form of media that's, you know, sold
right.
in stores?
Right now.
I think you're overstating the presence and prominence of Blu-ray.
That's true.
I don't think...
No, not just Blu-ray, but DVD and all that kind of stuff. People like to have use their old movies.
Here's my thoughts on DVD, because I've recently been just perusing big box stores for DVD media, trying to fill in a couple gaps in my collection. Have you been to a Best Buy or a Target or lately?
Of course.
It's
winding down, of course.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about what people are going to be buying new. We're talking about what they already have.
Okay.
So in a sense, if you're telling people throw out all your old electronics and buy this Xbox 720, hook it up to a TV and you're set, people will be like, but I can't use it to play. Yeah. You know, my copy of
then
you
will
the
have
mask.
To, then you will you know? Have to like, then you will have to keep your 360.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of like it kind of bites itself in the ass as a marketing slogan at that point.
That's interesting, but I think the marketing division of any company, like Microsoft or Sony, they're not concerned with what you already own. In fact, they'd rather you not own anything. They're only concerned about what you can buy in the future that will put money in their pocket. So they're not, as each generation rolls on, I don't think we're going to see as big a concern for things like backwards compatibility or whether or not it'll play your Blu-rays or your DVDs. It's unfortunate. I just think that ultimately the profits, they see that they're squarely in people rebuying stuff digitally now. We are in the era now where you can get every CD that you want on iTunes, you can get every movie you want digitally. If you're not pirating them, you can get them through affordable channels online.
And even Microsoft's own Zune store offers a film that you can buy or rent.
Yep, and you might even put them on a Zune.
Yes.
If you still have one.
If you're cool.
Yeah. Which
I just think in the long run, it's something of a risk.
Or in the future, a Windows 8 tablet.
If one of them says, well, we're not going to have the Blu-ray, the other one says we are.
Yeah, sure.
But
I have to ask you,
they're both talking about center of media center.
No,
one
you
has
definitely
it, one
have
doesn't.
A point. You definitely have a point there. I think for this first upcoming generation, backward compatibility, at least with Blu-ray and DVD, is a must-have. At least for this current upcoming generation. For the one beyond that, if we go another 5, 6, 7 years. It wouldn't matter as much. By that point we will move on to all digital.
Optical DVD / Blu-ray / physical copy movies in retail are going to make much of an impact in the next generation following this one at all. I think they're going to move into the same relegated space as CDs, people who are buying audio on CD, music and whatnot. I think it's going to move so far into a realm of Joe, didn't you rip your entire DVD collection to digital at this point?
I did. I kept a very small, sentimental collection.
Yeah, it's for convenience's sake and for the company. Like, the movie companies have pretty much exhausted their profitability on double-dipping and triple-dipping on existing films right now. Now they want to sell you an inexpensive digital copy, $10, make another bang profit. For people who want to get all their movie collection again through legitimate means, who aren't ripping their collection down. What's interesting to me, and I still have that devil's advocate thing running through my head, like, it's like, oh, this next generation, there's no way they can go all digital. It's not that I disagree with that, it's just that I would love to see the actual statistics of profitability on this generation from start to finish of Xbox Live and PlayStation Network and Wii Virtual Console / WiiWare, whatever, how much money that is made in comparison to the physical media. If it's even 25% versus 75% of what physical media makes, I'm sure all these companies see it as the future. It's like, okay, it's not there yet, but they know how to make it go up. How to make it either through forcing arbitrarily us to have to go that route or enticing us or figuring out that price model structure that works for the iTunes Store or Steam. Eliminating the entire... What was that?
No, my hair. I don't know what you're talking about.
Someone was touching me.
The hair.
Bad touch or good touch?
It's bad.
It's always a bad touch.
My genitals are actually in my hair.
Well, when it's not Rosamelia, it's a bad touch.
Anyway, I had a point. It was that I think that I would love to see it. And also I would love to see how real stats, I don't know if it's possible, how much bandwidth that has actually, on a weekly basis, how much is actually downloaded on national cable internet providers on Xbox Live and PlayStation Network, and how much more would need to be eaten up for it to be go all digital. You know, you say that there's no real limit. Those are all kind of fakey things that the cable companies hold over our heads, kind of as like a...
Those bastards.
We'll take it away from you if you download too much. So maybe Sony and Nintendo and Microsoft are smarter than the general populace. They know that all that's bullshit, and that if the cable companies pull, they could push back and say, you know... I don't know. Maybe they're in a better position of power. Maybe they actually. Maybe they're working backroom deals right now. Maybe Microsoft.
Collusion?
Yeah, maybe there's collusion. Maybe Microsoft and Sony are talking with these cable companies and saying, look, guys, next generation, we're going massively more digital. It's in your best interest not to throttle this stuff. If you see that it's coming from our networks, you know, let it go. Like, you know, tell your. You know, or charge your network like a small fee, like a Microsoft / Sony, an extra dollar a month to be able to download the 50 gig games, like some crazy thing that doesn't make sense from a scientific perspective, but will work for everybody involved who needs to profit.
I just think it's
that
going, it
will
would be
lead
going.
To riots.
I just think it's going, it would be going.
It will.
On the internet.
Well, look, no. It will lead to legitimate happenings because. It didn't happen with Comcast because Comcast is just too damn big and no one had a choice. But when Time Warner tried it, Time Warner serves more areas that have competition, like Fios. They couldn't get away with that. They couldn't get away with their caps.
Yeah.
Right. So because there was competition,
they got up. They
Time Warner
away.
Had to say, all right, they backed down. And this was, I think, 2 years ago at this point. They said, no, we have to because our infrastructure is getting hit. All right, it's already been 2-3 years at this point, and they haven't complained since. Obviously, that was false.
Well, again, I'm just in a devil's advocate position because I can never feel comfortable with the black and white of this has to happen or this can't happen.
Oh, it will happen eventually.
I just think
just
it's really
not
tough.
This upcoming generation.
I just think it's really tough because somebody's always got to be the first one, unless there really is collusion.
Someone's going to blink.
Well, that's what I mean, because what would happen is if you're going to be the first one to do something like that, there's a real good incentive to defect because now all of a sudden you're in the position where you're taking all the risk and Comcast is doing this, Sony's doing this, Nintendo's doing this, Time Warner's doing this. And if one party in there does something that screws you over, you're the one eating all the risk at that point.
I mean,
and
where
it's
do
sort
you
of like everyone's sort of watching everybody else, you know, it's like who's gonna do it first and what if it doesn't work? You know, it's like...
Now, here's another thing to think about, too. If they did go an all-digital route, there's no more middleman. There's no GameStop. Why do games still need to be $60?
There could... I mean, GameStop is trying to future-proof.
Correct.
We see them selling certificates. So people who are, you know, don't want to share their credit card information with PlayStation Network or Xbox Live, they can walk into GameStop and buy a download code.
Right, you can.
$50 with cash.
But think about it.
I mean
it's the same price.
Will
it's the same price, you know? Like, why?
Well, GameStop will have to become a more retro-centric store at that point.
Right.
Like, they're going to have to start stocking.
But they are trying to get into the digital thing, too.
Yeah. They have to. But here's another thought. You guys are bigger PC gamers than I am. I don't game at all on PC.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole, like, oh, you know, the consoles can't do these 10 gig download games or 20 or 50 or whatever the modern equivalent of how many gigs a modern game is. I know PC gaming makes up a much smaller percentage of the gaming populace in America, but aren't like all of the modern games from Activision and EA and everything available on Steam? And I mean, aren't those downloads going on right now? Like people are buying Mass Effect 3 and Left 4 Dead 2 and Team Fortress and all this stuff and like downloading these massive files and stuff, isn't it the same? Isn't that kind of paving the way? Like, don't you think Sony and Microsoft are looking at that and going like, well, it's happening on PC and it's not, no one, there's no kerfuffles there. Like, let's do it.
Well, the difference there is that on PC, anyone who's a PC gamer, maybe 8 times out of 10 is someone that knows what they're doing, because the majority of PC gamers are people that either built their own machines, to play these games because you really have to know what you're doing when it comes to PC gaming. Or they're someone who had the money to buy a really good gaming PC and they understand, like, okay, I'm going to get a good internet connection so I can play this. Whereas consoles, it's usually someone who's like, I just want to play the game. I don't care about the graphics. I just want to put it in, play it. I don't want to set it up. I don't want to upgrade it, blah, blah, blah. It's a different market. And like you pointed out, the PC gaming market is a lot smaller than the console market. Not that it's non-existent. It's just that those are two different animals. And I'm not saying you can't store that much info on a console. You can. It's just what I'm saying is the majority of America doesn't have the broadband capability to do that on their consoles.
Yeah. Not now, but
not right now.
I mean, it's
and not it's for kinda, not for a while.
We'll see. I mean, it's a what if.
I'll put it to you this way: one of the fastest download speeds you can get over here is maybe 100, 150 megabits per second, and you're gonna pay.
Can you put that frame of reference?
Yeah. You could download almost 150 megabytes per second at that speed. Which is, that's a good amount of data that you can download all at once. You could download several gigs in minutes.
That's like 150 megabytes. What game is that equivalent? 150 megabytes, is that a Super Nintendo game? Is that a...
Oh, that's way above. That's way above.
That's a PlayStation 1 game?
You could download a PlayStation 1 game in seconds.
PlayStation 1 game, but yeah, you're talking about like 600
megabytes.
Megs.
You could download a PlayStation 1 game in seconds.
Okay, so it's a PS4.
That's on the fastest connection. Now,
so like within 10 minutes you can get like Mass Effect.
Yes, you could. Yeah. But you have to really pay for those. Those are $100 and up just for the internet connection alone.
Those are like T3 type ones.
Well, actually cable is capable of that speed.
Right.
And they only have to upgrade their infrastructure on the back end. Time Warner recently did this where their service used to be 20 megabits, then they upgraded to 50. And the only thing the customer needed was a new modem, and that was it. But you had to go from paying $100 for a triple play to $100 just for the internet on its own. In Japan, they have a 1 gigabit connection that costs you $30 a month. And that's many times faster than what I'm talking about here. And that's one of their slower services.
That's a whole lot of tentacle porn.
Yes, exactly. You could download the internet of tentacle porn. I've done it.
I had a 1400 baud modem for my Commodore 64, and one time when I first plugged it in, I was in a chat room of BBS, I think it was the jungle, and I was in a private chat with somebody that only had a 300 baud modem, and I was typing like, oh yeah, did you see that episode of that TV show? And they were like, you're typing too fast.
You get like, one letter a
minute. Yeah, the keystrokes actually were...
Slow it down, you bastard.
They were scrolling their screen up too fast.
Not everyone has the lightning speed internet that you
and
do.
This was 1989, yes. So we've come a long way.
We have come a long way. Although, greed is getting in the way of progress now.
Greed always gets in the way of progress.
More so now than before.
Well, it's always been that way. We're just more aware of it now because we're older and we know what's going on more.
Well, technology hasn't been as monetized as it,
true,
you know. Right. Think of all the gadgets that you have available now that weren't around in the 90s.
Yeah.
And you're holding the ultimate symbol of monetization of technology in your hands.
Maybe rabbit ears... What are we like? 10?
10.
Come on.
On another note, then,
40 years ago,
how about backwards compatibility in general?
30 years.
You know, they're talking about the new PlayStation might not have the Cell processor. Sony might be backing away from that.
Yeah, I think that Sony is not going to... If I had a guess, anyway, I think Sony's not even going to bother with PS3 backwards compatibility. However, I wouldn't be surprised if they stick PS2 backwards compatibility in there.
Yes, it'll be
just
software.
Because it's, you know, it's really time for them to retire the physical PS2 hardware, which has got to be the longest running string of console manufacturing ever. Like,
are they still manufacturing
2001
it?
2001?
Might be.
PS2?
I don't think so.
No.
I think they're done manufacturing it.
Yeah. You can still find them new.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I mean,
it's just that they made so many.
I don't think they've officially retired it. I think that...
Right, I don't think...
There's still some games coming out.
Yeah, mostly
trickling down.
Mostly sports.
It's insane, but yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if that, as like a legacy thing, mm-hmm. like, plays PS1. It's going to play PS1 games.
Right.
So
well, that's all software-based at this point.
Yeah. They have that.
And they'll just sell them.
So
they'll just keep selling them on the...
Well, what's interesting is that, I mean, they're still making, essentially still making PlayStation 1 games. And they're minis. Minis
right.
is
yeah.
running
minis?
On PlayStation 1. You know, it's basically PS1 games.
They were like, you know, you program on this PS1 dev kit, we'll sell it as a mini. And it's really cool. Like, the minis are woefully underutilized. I wish Sony had gotten like bigger developers to like get involved with that whole initiative. Companies like Capcom or Namco, or you know, companies that could have made more of what was available.
There's some really interesting things that are out there, like that. Where's My Heart game is phenomenal. If you've never played it, run out and get it now. It's well worth getting.
But backwards compatibility is definitely interesting notion and. I always think Xbox 360 kind of like didn't quite grab the bull by the horns with that either. There's pockets of original Xbox games.
Yeah, they couldn't. The hardware was drastically different.
But they did manage to
emulate
in a way
that
like.
What they did was
some things worked perfectly.
I think they said like at the point where they stopped, they said. At this point, we hit all like the key games, and at this point, everything else is sort of like one-offs.
Yeah.
And it's just not worth it.
Yeah, they. Yeah. But at least you can still get that even on the slims, whereas Sony has completely killed PS2 backward compatibility.
No, but Sony has mastered the software emulation on the current generation. Now they're.
You can't do the emulation on the current PS4.
No,
but
you're talking about Sony.
No, you can, but. You purchase the games
right.
and you download them.
Right.
There are PS2 games that are online
but
on
that's,
the store.
That's basically their way of making you
of course,
rebuy a game you already have.
Exactly.
Now,
but it's
Microsoft at least
positive.
Microsoft at least offers games that you can emulate for Xbox originals.
Well, that's
right.
true.
Yeah. That's fine. But the bottom line to me is Sony is proving whether or not it's a middle finger to the owner of the console. They've proven that yes. We can emulate
yes.
these games, and you
we
can
just,
buy them.
We just chose not.
And
to.
We're going to give you the greatest hits, but like to us, it's more important to eke that profit out
yes.
of these games one last time. Which is, I can't fault them for that because that is that's this industry. I mean, every company does that. Every major publisher, every major developer, some do it in a more profitable. Like you have a company like Sega that'll give you 20 games for $20 of their classics library, and then you've got Namco that'll give you maybe 10 or 15. You got Capcom that'll give you 4 or 5 in a classics collection, and you know.
But
Sony's
that makes
like,
more sense. Those are games that you can't play on that hardware.
Sure, but I'm just saying that it is the way of this business now. It's like,
and at least
for
they
years,
come with
they,
extras.
They gave us backwards compatibility, hat in hand. They said. Your new console can play all of your old games, and then they realize that there's a lot of those old games that people would gladly. I mean, how many times have we bought Super Mario Brothers on every Nintendo console? Like every Nintendo console, with the exception of Nintendo 64, has given us an opportunity to rebuy Super Mario Brothers, and we've done it willingly. Like, yes, take my money, Nintendo. I'm like that Fry JPG. Like, you know, here, take my money. So it's. You know.
Also, I think from a PR perspective, I think Sony learned this, that ultimately it's people will forget. Like, they may want backwards compatibility, but if they don't have it, if it's just not given to them initially, they'll forgive. And they'll get. But people will be a little bit more pissed off, maybe for a little bit longer, a little more bitter, if it's given to them and it's taken away.
Sony has
definitely
learned.
Basically,
don't
even give it to begin with.
If you want to sell these old games to people, don't let them play it in the first place, and then it's more acceptable.
Yeah, that was definitely.
Like, don't even give the option at that point. Just put the machine out and do what you're going to do.
Have you looked up the PS3 on Wikipedia?
No.
They have the feature list?
Yeah.
It goes down as you go along the lifeline of the system. SACD playback, Linux support, HDMI, and all that. And all right, all green check marks on the first one, and then this check mark goes away. This one goes away. That one goes away. That one goes away.
Well, HDMI never went away.
No, actually, that's one feature that it actually gained as it went.
No, it always
had HDMI.
No, I mean, it went from HDMI 1.3.
Oh.
Mm. And then it went
through
to real
firmware or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, no. That was when they did the newer, the Slim.
Oh, okay. They changed it up.
In Blu-ray terms, you couldn't bitstream high def audio to your receiver with the original PS3.
Right, right.
But when they made the Slim, they fixed the HDMI port to allow you to bitstream.
Interesting.
But you can't. It's not HDMI 1.4. What that means is, you know how they have the high def sound on the Blu-ray?
Yeah.
On the original PS3. Mm. The PS3 mixes all the sound and sends it to your speakers. When you bitstream it, you're telling the PS3 to send it in raw format to your surround sound receiver to do the mixing and then send that to your speakers.
But you have to make sure that you purchase HDMI 1.4 compatible cables to be able to handle all that, right? They have the extra, no?
Doesn't matter for...
Those are for just
well,
features.
That's for 3D.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter on the PS3 because it's not a 1.4 system. Actually, if it does a 3D Blu-ray, it doesn't do it in high-def sound. It downmixes it to DVD quality because it doesn't have the bandwidth. But that's neither here nor there.
Tricks of the trade.
Yes, tricks of the trade.
HDMI standards do not have anything to do with backwards compatibility.
Yes.
You know, that's... it's interesting how we go through these console generations and we see that these companies make these stumble steps and they learn and we see them kind of... And I'm never the kind of guy that likes to believe that these corporations have clandestine meetings where they're like, ooh, we can't give them backwards compatibility in the next generation, we must make money. But there probably are legitimate business decisions that are done in a more reasonable fashion that are like...
Hopefully.
They're not all Mr. Burns.
No, they're not.
Would
not
it
like
cost
Cobra
us?
Yeah. Like, I will use the Weather Dominator and eliminate all backwards compatibility.
See, now, it makes more sense when... At least when Microsoft did it with Xbox 360, there was a legitimate reason for not having perfect backward compatibility. You went from a system completely different, GPU and CPU. So from a hardware perspective, okay, I understand that. Now, Sony, when they first made the PS3, actually had the processor from the PS2 in it that they later took out but still let you emulate. Okay, fine. Then later on, when they started releasing, it was still the FAT at the time. It was the same hardware, just different hard drive size. They took it away. No reason for that to happen.
No, there was a reason for that.
Yeah,
it was
cost.
They wanted to eliminate some... They said that it was a cost-cutting procedure, but also...
There's no cost-cutting procedure removing software emulation.
No.
When they removed the physical part...
They had two chips in there.
Yeah.
And
it was
they took
the
one
emotion
out,
engine.
And then they emulated that in software. They took the other chip out as the final cost cutting.
There was
another
chip, was there?
Yes, there was two.
There was two of them in there? Because I know
they
had the emotion engine in there.
The emotion engine.
Yes.
So they took the emotion engine out first.
Yeah.
And that was the one they emulated. Am
apparently.
Right?
I didn't realize there were two chips in there.
The emotion engine was emulated in the GPU of the PS2.
That was
the final one that was removed, which prevented even the people who were jailbreaking the PS3s later in their life, they couldn't even like run code to emulate. They couldn't put the stuff back in because it didn't physically have the hardware
to do it.
But
how did the
PS2 also the bottom line is that Sony was making
it's like a self-contained emulator.
Okay, so like a WiiWare kind of virtual console kind
like the clandestine kind of backroom stuff that I'm talking about is the bottom line is Sony's making a lot more money selling physical PS2s at the time that they eliminated that compatibility from PS3. When they could make 200% profit on the manufacturing of one PS2 and sell it, you know, for $99 or whatever it was, or $150 at the time, they'd much rather keep selling those PS2s than include that backwards compatibility and sell a couple extra games.
They need the money right now. They're falling on some hard times.
He wants to steer the company in the right direction. He hopefully will be for Sony what Steve Jobs was in bringing Apple back from that weird 90s iMac.
Goldblum?
Yeah, that drunk Jeff Goldblum.
That was actually a success for them.
They
sold a lot of those things.
But as a technology company, they weren't.
Right, they weren't innovators at the time.
Yeah,
Jeff Goldblum bought them all.
Yeah,
very drunk.
At the time. I don't have an email.
He's got a garage of all the iMacs to this day. What was I thinking on that binge?
So I'm looking forward to Sony with Kaz Hirai at the helm. He's a smart guy, I think, and he's proven to weather some serious storms with that organization. You know, and who knows if, you know, maybe Sony in 10 years won't exist as a console manufacturer anymore. Maybe we'll
possible
like
Sega.
Did happen to Sega. We said never.
And Atari.
Atari
that
yeah,
was one of the most prominent.
It happened.
So
now, I guess another thing that might be a little interesting tidbit. Supposedly now, in terms of hardware for these upcoming consoles, it looks like it might be AMD doing the graphics for all of them. And what is that clicking sound?
The camera.
It's another camera.
Damn you, Enforcer! But now, if that happens, we'll actually be in it's somewhat of an interesting phase, because AMD already does the graphics for the Wii and the 360, and it's NVIDIA for the PS3. Now, supposedly, AMD has struck a deal with all the console manufacturers. All right, we're going to give you the graphics for all these systems.
What? That's a monopoly.
That
antitrust.
That might actually lead us to an era. That will actually might lead us to an era where multi-platform games look almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
Where now,
no more,
now
like,
they'll they might now we might have to fall back to the era where exclusives are what sell the system, and not so much what the system can do online.
Not gonna matter. You know, how many cores are in your Xbox.
Right. I mean, the CPU is a different discussion, but at least the look of the games
will
be...
Would the CPU matter more in that respect than the CPU?
Depends on the architecture that they go for. One of the reasons...
You're supposed to have all the answers.
Well, I'll put it to you this way.
Cores.
I'll put it to you this way.
GPUs.
The PS3 has technically a more powerful CPU than the 360.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really see the benefits of that in almost any multi-platform game, and even in the exclusives that they do have that look fantastic, aren't 10 times better than what you get on the 360. And the reason for that is because the Xbox went with a GPU design that was more advanced than what the PS3 has, and also the processor in that system is a lot easier to code for. It's closer to what developers encounter in PC development, and it was easier for them to wrap their heads around. Sony was like, well, look at all the power you have here. This one does this one
power
does that.
Power they don't know how to
yeah,
use.
But that's,
actually,
that's why
the last time
the
that happened was the Sega Saturn.
So good at unfolding human DNA.
Exactly. Actually, it's kind of similar to what happened with the Sega Saturn.
Then the Jaguar had the same problem, right?
Yeah, it was difficult to develop for.
Well, the Jaguar was
the timing,
like,
right?
Crippled.
The timing
yeah,
between them.
From what it was
yes,
originally.
Tom and Jerry, right?
Yeah, Tom and Jerry.
Or something like that.
And it happened with the Saturn. The Saturn was actually what you would call now a dual-core system, if you will. It had two CPUs in it. Theoretically, a very powerful system. Theoretically, more powerful than the PS1. You didn't really see that. It was difficult to program for, and ultimately, that was one of the reasons PS1 won out.
So go keep it simple, stupid, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think this next generation, hopefully, the engineers who are designing the architecture of these systems, it's clear to them like what direction the games have moved in and what they need to have these systems kind of set up from the get-go to be able to do easy to program for, have dev kits that accommodate for like indie kind of developing, small studio works that for stuff that's going to be available on download services, but also stuff that scales up, that
yeah,
you know, they can design
it's
these like
power to last.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare
right,
10 with, you know, graphics so realistic that it looks like a guy is actually putting his hands up and making like rabbit signs behind your
4K
head. And it's like
4K rabbit.
Anyone want to go for price point guesses? What do you think we're going to debut at?
I wouldn't expect more than $399.
Yeah, between
I think,
three and
yeah,
four.
I think once you get to that point when you pass 400, I think that's when people start to back off. You know,
like what happened to PS3?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it was
Sony
5
and
7.
And there are rumors going around as now when we get back to the hardware discussion again. There are rumors going around as to what's going to go in what system. What I'm hearing about the next Xbox right now is making me think a $400 to $500 system, but Sony proved You can still sell those units at that price, but I think 400 is probably going to be the cheapest of what we see.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think it's worth the negative press. I don't think it's
yeah,
worth an entire cycle, a quarter of a generation
yeah,
of people being critical.
Yeah, you
of
can't
them.
You can't play
a soft
catch
start
up
like that.
Yeah.
You know, I think people are perfectly okay with the $300 price point, $299.99.
$300. That's very optimistic.
Yeah. But what I think that people are very okay with that, and I think up to like the $399.99, that's when they're sort of
okay.
Once you go past that, I think people start saying, you know what, this little box that I already have is doing me all right for the time being.
Well, the interesting thing is, we might not have systems that surpass PCs at their launch like we had with the 360 and the PS3, because at their launch, they were more powerful than the best PC at that time. This might be the first time in years that we don't have that again.
Well, when you say the divide of PC gamers right now, I mean, like, is that a market that they feel they need to capture, like, or they need to impress enough to pull them away from PC gaming? I think that's kind of a microcosmos of...
Well, the PC gamers have the argument that consoles right now are holding back development of games as a whole because they're not as powerful. They develop for consoles first and then backport to PC. They might get better textures here and there, but a game that's developed solely for the PC from the get-go will have some mind-blowing graphics if you have the budget and someone's willing to do it.
At the cost, though, of people who don't have those super gaming rigs having to run it on lower settings.
And another argument is that piracy is so prevalent on PC that it's not worth to develop for it, and blah, blah, blah. But it's true in a way that development is somewhat hobbled by current generation systems. I don't think it's a horrible thing right now because there's still, with clever developers, you can still get some amazing graphics out of the systems as they stand now. But we probably are a little bit due for a new generation that might open up new possibilities.
New generation. Are you buying Sony? Are you buying Microsoft? Are you buying Nintendo?
I will eventually get all three at some point.
Which one's first?
Probably Microsoft.
Okay, how about you?
Yeah, eventually I'll end up getting all three first. Honestly, I'll probably try out the Wii U first, probably because I expect it to be the cheapest.
That's going to
be
out
first.
So, by default, I guess.
Cheapest,
yeah.
You know, I figure like there'll be a
wise, Gabe, you're getting a Nintendo first. Wise!
At that point, I'll have no choice. Yeah. They'll be out first.
Yeah. All right, Frank, what do you think?
So Wii U is going to launch first. I'll have that first. If Microsoft and Sony launch their console, let's say, a couple months apart in the same calendar year, which I think they absolutely have to. Sony cannot trail Xbox in this next generation with the breadth of, what was it, a year?
Yeah, it was
like a year. I'll probably buy the Sony first, and then, I mean... But I'll own them all. I have to. I'm not a console gamer that can afford to miss anything. Like I have to exclusives on every platform. They mean the world to me. I don't like to be left in the cold, and I genuinely appreciate everything that every console puts forth. I have no major preferences other than the fact that this might be eliminated in this next generation moving forward. My backwards compatibility library has been primarily Sony. Like, I've gone Sony with my primary console in multiple generations because PS1 to PS2 to PS3, I've been able to play everything going from system to system. But if that's not the case, maybe that won't matter so much to me. Maybe I will get a Microsoft console first, and then it'll depend on what the launch lineups are, what the exclusives are. If it's exclusive on launch, Halo or Gears of War for Microsoft versus an Uncharted or... God of War or Infamous, I'm going to go with the Sony thing because I love their first party stuff. I'm not a Halo player, I'm not a Gears of War player, I'm not a whatever Microsoft's first party stuff is on their launch lineups. So, but I'll get them.
Cool.
What about you?
The Super Game Module for the ColecoVision from Opco Games, that's what I'm getting next, and hopefully the XM Module for 7800 will be out. I'll have that as well.
I would imagine that the graphics on those have got to be mind-blowing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
They have two extra sound chips, a Pokey and a YM.
In crystal clear, monitorable sound.
That's what I'll be getting.
And if you're lucky to have a CRT that does color, in color.
So, hey, that's the end of this segment.
Chroma Luma. on the Commodore. You got to have Chroma monitor.
That's true. But that's what we're playing, and we'll be talking about what we're playing. But that's what we're waiting for. and we'll talk next. Yeah. See you. Hey, welcome to the next segment. We're going to be talking about
what are you playing?
Are you playing?
What are you playing?
What are you playing?
So, I guess
I'll start.
Kind of moderating. Sure. Mike, what are you playing right now?
Well, right now, I wish I could remember the web address. It's on the board.
I can add it in later.
It was mentioned on the boards in one of the threads.
Magic.
That basically, it's a website that recreates a number of the Game & Watch games.
In Flash.
Yeah, in Flash. And they play fantastic. The website itself, it's Flash, so it only supports keyboards, but you can use Joy2Key.
Free software.
It's free software to basically just act as, you know, it turns your gamepad into, you know, keyboard, it basically assigns the gamepad buttons to a keyboard.
Basically, you can assign any key to any input command on a USB joystick,
exactly.
Which is great for the Game & Watches because not all of them up and down and left and right and the buttons equal the same thing on every Game & Watch.
Mm-hmm. But you know, with Joy2Key and even with a keyboard for a lot of them, you know, I was playing Octopus for about an hour. You know, the Zelda, the Game & Watch version of Zelda, which is, you know, surprisingly well designed for, you know, what you would expect. And it's just great. You know, I mean, there's a bunch of games already on there. I think it seems like they're about to add more. It says coming soon for a couple more.
I think it may have.
Yeah.
It coming soon for a long time.
Yeah.
I've seen that website before.
Oh, have you?
But I know it's a recent discovery.
This is the first time I've heard of it, and it's fantastic. I was playing some Game & Watch games that I've never played before, and you know, you always find new things that from, you know, old gems that you never heard of.
Yeah, I was like, why haven't I played that website before? And then I was like, oh yeah, because I have all this. I usually just play the actual game.
Oh, I own them all already.
I own all of the Game & Watch.
I'm special.
I wish I did.
How many do you think you're missing?
I'll get back to you in a moment.
I have an app
on my phone.
Oh, I thought you had them all in your pocket.
I carry them all around.
What's your don't look it up. What's your like? What's the white whale for you? What's the one that you really need that you really want to get?
Thank you.
It was Rain Shower for a long time, but I actually got that, which completed my multi-screen collection. I have all of the vertical multi-screens. There's 12 of those that open like this, the two screens. I have all three of the horizontal multi-screens, and I have all three of the Versus units that have the two controllers inside. And then I have about like 20 of the widescreen single ones.
Oh, the tough ones are those panoramas, right?
I have no panoramas. I only have one tabletop, the Popeye tabletop. And I would like the panoramas, and I would honestly like a lot of the core classic widescreens like Chef and Fire and Judge. And I have the repro of Ball. I love the original Ball. But, I mean, those tend to be the ones that were the most common in Japan and the ones that kind of started the whole thing are the ones that didn't really make it to the United States and are harder to get and tend to be pricier. They're just not...
What's the one that you want, though? The one you got to, like, if I could just add one more.
She blows!
Probably Chef. I would really like to get my hands on Chef.
That was a Japanese only?
No, I mean, it was those widescreens were available in the United States in some limited capacity, but they weren't as widely produced and imported as the later edition widescreen ones like Super Mario Brothers, Climber, Mario the Juggler. Like there was a whole generation of ones that were more widely available at Toys R Us.
Mario the Juggler.
Those are like last. It's Ball with just Mario.
Oh yeah,
it's Mario. Juggling.
What's Mario doing juggling balls? That doesn't sound like a Nintendo approved game.
Something that Peach is responsible for.
Next, please.
Anyway, Mike is playing Game & Watch
on the website,
it'll say it on your screen.
It'll be right here.
In post production, Mike's gonna put it on the bottom of the screen, and then it's gonna spiral around. Zoom in and out.
Maybe all that extra stuff. If you guys want this podcast done expeditiously, it'll
Ooh,
just
good
be
word.
On the screen.
Keywords.
I know. Gabe, what are you playing now?
So I recently started playing the first Witcher on PC in anticipation of the second one on Xbox now.
What is it called, the first?
The Witcher.
A Witcher, okay.
Yeah, because the second one just came out on Xbox, and I want to play it, but I'm one of those guys that I got to play part one first. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Witcher series at all. I don't know if you've been hearing anything about it now.
I just saw the box here at the store.
I was actually surprised that it's been getting a lot of hype online because it was such a well-received RPG. But it's basically a big open-world RPG, and I've only really just started it. The fighting style is actually pretty unique. The way it works is it is click to slash, but what happens is you click and he goes into an animation where he's just kicking the crap out of the guy, and then there's like a quick highlight on the mouse. Click again and you do a super combo and you keep doing that. It's actually a really cool game so far.
Is it timing based, the click? Like,
yeah, it's timing based. If you miss it, you kind of start from square one. So if you do three in a row correctly, that's like an insta kill on the enemy.
Like Def Jam Icon. Hooray!
is it similar to
Kudos to Nuda is listening to this going like, yeah!
Is that good or bad?
Is it similar to Dungeons of Daggeroth? You know, the game that you were telling me.
It's completely the same, right down to the 8-bit monochrome. You know,
wireframe.
It's 3D wireframe.
Dungeons
yeah.
of Daggeroth. But so go on with The Witcher though. How are you liking the first one?
So far I'm really impressed with it. My understanding of it is there are going to be points in the game where you make these decisions that will actually completely change later sections of the game plot-wise. And where you play. So I'm looking forward to trying that out. And I'll probably have to do like 10 saves and go back and change every little thing. But it seems like it's a little bit complex to get into, so I'll be interested to see how they translated the second one to the Xbox controller.
Is the Xbox 360 version going to have all the nudity and sex?
It does, actually. Yeah. I remember reading that it will. And the PC one didn't have it at first. That was actually a later patch.
By Witcher 2.
Yeah, it's like that's yeah. pretty much.
That's like the running joke.
A major component is that he sleeps with like.
Yeah, you
after
can.
You
yeah.
kill like the creature, you immediately sleep with a sexy elf or something.
Yeah,
like
I keep
like.
Hearing that.
And the part of the game is every time you have sex with one of the characters, you collect like a card of that person that you slept with.
That's kind of like my wife.
Actually,
so you have no cards.
It's in the first within the first hour of The Witcher 1,
well,
you can sleep with
card.
A girl. Actually, within the first hour of The Witcher, you can sleep with a female, and that's. You know, usually that's something that happens
it's
30
alien,
hours
you know,
into the game. No, it's in the first hour. If you say the right thing, she'll be like, oh, let's go to bed.
That seems like a lot compared to what I've read about that game. I heard that, like, as soon as you enter, like, the disc, like, key, it, like, has him having sex.
You press start right at the beginning.
Yeah.
It sounds like a Rose
awesome.
Amelia game.
It's all about the boobies. Witcher.
And I've also tried out The Binding of Isaac, which... Really
less
is
sex
it is no there's like sex but I'm wondering which one is more disturbing. Your weapon is literally the tears of your main character.
What?
It literally is.
Would you cry on people?
Like yes, you really
wait,
do.
Wait, explain
yes.
the core of the narrative of Binding of Isaac for anybody who hasn't played it yet because it's a really controversial game.
So here's the game starts out. It's got a simple animation style, stick figure type of characters, and the opening is narrated. What basically happens is it's a mother and son. They live home alone together, and one day the mother hears the voice of God saying, "Your son is corrupt. Take away all these things to purify him." And she does all these things, and it gets to the point where he says, "I'm still not convinced your son is good. You have to sacrifice him to me and prove your faith." Which is actually taken from a real story in the Bible. So Isaac, running for his life, jumps into the basement, which is apparently filled with shit, literally. All these creatures, and it's basically in the exact style of Zelda. The rooms, it has the same perspective. It's the same sort, it has the same icons for the boss that you would, like the skull. And as I said, your main weapon is literally the tears of your character.
So Zelda with more tears and human sacrifice?
It's emo Zelda.
So when you start out, is there like some guy who's like, it's dangerous to go alone, take this. And
you're literally dropped into the middle of the game after the narration, and the first room, the tile graphic is the instructions on how to play the game. And it's played like a twin stick shooter, which is kind of weird because I'm thinking I'm playing Zelda where I just press a button to do a sword slash or something. But it's played like a twin stick shooter in that WASD, which you could think of as like the left thumbstick. And the arrow keys aim where your projectile tiers go. So it really is like a twin stick shooter. But I remember like, wait, tiers? Okay. There's power-ups. One of the power-ups is like a third eye in the forehead, so you shoot like three tiers at once. It's a good game, but it's difficult and interesting, to say the least. The child abuse, yes. And that's not why, again, that's not why it was denied by Nintendo. The religious imagery was the problem. Child abuse is okay.
Yeah.
I keep seeing the game. In fact, I know I downloaded it, but I keep seeing it for sale on Steam, and at some point I downloaded it because I see all my friends playing it too, and I just haven't gotten around to it. But
yeah,
it sounds a lot more interesting than
the
screenshots that I saw.
Oh, it's really interesting. Yeah. The descriptions and the screenshots don't do it justice. Like, when I tried it out, I was like, okay, I don't know why I didn't do this sooner.
Good to know.
So, Joe, what are you playing now?
I haven't been playing as much as I normally do or as I'd like to. I've got Mass Effect 3 sitting there mocking me. It's just sitting there on my table where I'm like, the first chance I get to play something that's going to be right there. I played maybe 2 hours of that game and really didn't think much of it. So it wasn't... the first 2 hours weren't gripping enough to get me into it. And now that I've heard how terrible the ending is, I'm less likely to jump back in. I've been spending more time on my portable devices than usual, and other than gaming, I've been doing turntable.fm, which is this really cool application where, I've been looking for something like Pandora. I think I was actually doing a search for, like, where can I listen to music that's things that I like in my theme, but I don't have to listen to commercials, and they're not going to fuck it up. And it came up with Turntable FM. So I tried this out, and basically...
You typed all of that.
I typed exactly
Google
like
works.
That.
That's how efficient Google is.
And like the first five links were Turntable.fm. So I tried it out, and sure enough, it's a thing where you get to pick a room that you want to be in. You can theme it. You can pick the theme that you like. And rather than a computer choosing what songs are going to be played... there are users basically moderating that room. So if you pick, which I was looking for, unusual 80s music, you have people that are really into unusual 80s music, and if some kid jumps in there and tries doing dubstep songs, they basically get thrown right off the room.
And
so it's almost
well,
like,
they should be.
So as you're listening to it, it's really cool. Like you every once in a while, like something that doesn't fit, and exactly as your brain would say, like, wait, this doesn't, it's gone. It's gone. And then you're on to the next song.
Yeah.
And what's really cool about it is that even if you're not just listening, if you want to really sit there and play around with it, it's a kind of a cool social media thing where, like Facebook or any other sort of chat application, you contact these people. Like
yeah,
you're up there talking,
to
oh, you like Devo too, I just saw them live.
Just to give people a background of what the interface looks like, it looks like a room and there are DJ turntables depending on how many are allowed in the room. They could be up to five.
It's up to five.
And everybody has a little avatar. They look like, a little cartoon character, and, they're either in the audience listening and you can see waiting to either go up and DJ
or just chill out, listen,
talking,
right.
Little word balloons, or you're the DJ up at the... It's a really cool graphical interface.
Yeah, and you can awesome or you can lame a song. So if like the dubstep comes on in the unusual 80s, you can just lame that.
Right, in a case where there's nobody actually moderating it.
You and I got a troll mic on this thing
enough
now.
People listening say lame, like this doesn't belong here, that song gets knocked right off.
Yeah, it
gets
knocked right off.
I'm wondering how often people rickroll on that.
Nobody.
No, no one. You're never playing. All of a sudden, never gonna give you one rock roll.
But that wouldn't that fit in the '80s room?
That would.
It's like, well, how do you rickroll someone in the '80s room?
Let me just say this though. Seriously, I am really into '80s music that you wouldn't know, but fits the '80s. And I've always considered myself an aficionado. But after just a couple of weeks on this Turntable FM with people that I've doubled what I've known. In a very short period of time. I've heard all kinds of things I'd never heard of before and have added it to my own library and have made some really cool friends.
Yeah, it's
so
it's
a great app. It's not a game, but it is a really cool online experience.
So what rooms do you go to frequent most?
My room is Unusual 80s,
so
but it's usually dead if I'm not there. So if I can't invite people to come,
he's DJing play
with
for
me,
himself.
But there's one called 80s Alt / New Wave, which kind of gets the same. And it's funny, but groups like in gaming, they sort of flock into the same sort of areas.
Yeah.
It's the same people that I see in my room that are in that particular room most of the time as well.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good app.
Good stuff.
So Frankie, what are you playing now?
I have been playing almost exclusively since I got back from PAX, because at PAX, it was one of the lines that wasn't, like, stretching around the entire room.
Orcs Must Die too?
No. I didn't get to play that, but that does look good. It looks as good, if not better, than the original.
Yeah, we gotta play that.
We're on that.
Kid Icarus on the 3DS. I have my Kid Icarus shirt that Nintendo...
Where'd you get that shirt? Oh, when you were there.
I played the game,
right.
And they gave me a shirt.
That's
they
right.
were like, take this shirt. And I said, thank you.
Now you're obligated.
I can't afford that.
They also gave me augmented reality cards, which are used in a in part of the game, and Nintendo does not sell those at retail in any capacity. If you weren't at PAX and you didn't get these packs of cards...
Then
until
you're paying insane amounts on
eBay.
Yeah,
on eBay, right, like ridiculous amounts. So I was fortunate enough to get some of those to play around with, but... The game is, I was kind of going, I really enjoy it, and I'm going through my head, like, what about this game am I so enamored with? And it hit me that Kid Icarus is the first-party Nintendo title that I can think of in a long, long time where all the characters are voiced and talk nonstop through the entirety of the game. Icarus and Palutena have conversations through the duration of every level that you're in. Now, I mean, that's something that's pretty sorely missing in a lot of Nintendo games. They have these voiceless protagonists, like Link and Zelda
hey,
and Mario.
Listen!
Yeah,
listen.
I mean, you get a little bit of babbling from Mario occasionally, and you get jibber-jabber and Star Fox that's like, you know,
right.
But Icarus and Palutena, not only are they charmingly voiced, really well voiced, but what they're saying is so hysterical. It's legitimately well written and funny and breaks the fourth wall. They reference the fact that they're in a game constantly. They constantly reference the original game that's 25 years old now, and it'll pop up with 8-bit graphics as they're explaining stuff, like on the bottom screen, like, hey, that's Eggplant Wizard. I remember that guy. And then Lady Palutena will say something like, yeah, he used to turn you into an eggplant and you used to have to go to a nurse, but you don't have to do that in this game. You know, there's no first aid places in this game. And he's like, are there credit cards? And, you know, like, they are always breaking the fourth wall, and on the bottom screen it'll do all kinds of great references. It's also, I say this with every new 3DS game that I play, the best 3D I've seen on the system. Mm-hmm. The flight sequences where you're flying through the sky and you're dipping down towards the ground, it has two sections of the game. One where you're flying, where it's like Star Fox, it's on rails, you're not controlling, you know, it's not free flight, so it's, you know, you're guided wherever they go, but, I mean, it still looks amazing. And then you've got on-foot sections, which, to me, remind me a lot of Kingdom Hearts, which also means that the gameplay mechanics are not incredibly well thought out, and they're pretty mediocre, but everything else about the game makes up for that, and it, like, you don't even think about the limitations or the minimalism of, like, you can't, there's no jump button, there's a lot of, you know, walking around, and there's, you have to use the stylus to aim, there's no way around it, so there's a lot of things that weren't designed with ease of play in mind. It also reminds me a lot of Metroid Prime Hunters on DS, which for playing that for long periods of time can be really strain on your wrist. Holding the system up and having to use the stylus constantly to aim can be strenuous, and they include that stand, which does help, but I don't really like sitting and playing my 3DS. I like to, you know, I like to be able to hold it in my hands and move it, you know, closer and further away if I need to. Having it, like, on a stand, you have to play it, like, at the same, you can't really move it, but all those things aside, what the game has going for it makes up for any shortcomings. Directed by the same guy who did, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, he did Super Smash Brothers, those games.
Sakurai, I think.
Sakurai, yes, yeah. Thank you. Sakurai, and it has like the same kind of menu screens as Super Smash Brothers. It's great. If you have any interest in it at all, if you were a fan of the original, you have to try it. It doesn't play like the original, but it is in spirit. So much going for it. Crack your copy open, man. Seriously.
Yeah, no, I picked it up, but I didn't get a chance to try it yet. Which actually, if you went to the new dpvideogames.com website in the forums, you would have had seen that conversation.
I did see it. That's Frankie, why I'm saying to open it.
I'm explaining to them that they can go and be a part of the community. Come to dpvideogames.com, where I actually post an arcade challenge of the week. And no one, except for Stephanie at the 11th hour, on one time on Hard Hat, came in and took it away from me. The 11th hour.
Well, you're the one picking the game.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I put out the hard stuff.
You always pick, like, some obscure title that some dude in his basement made when he was living with his mom and he was 14 years
Larry
old.
Larry Hutchinson, Exidy.
So you should make one of your challenges a game. Like, you pick the game, and I'll beat you at it.
Yeah.
That should be your challenge.
That could be a new challenge. Go to dpvideogames.com in the forum,
and see how it all turns out.
Mm-hmm. Mike's Arcade Corner. I could see this being a regular.
A couple weeks. Hey, why not, you know?
We'll call it the Mac.
Mike is a ruler
Mike's
of
arcade
a
corner.
Arcade Challenge Kingdom where only he can win.
I am.
That's why he picks the real games.
Hey, man, I put out the stuff that separates the real gamers from the little girls.
You pick out the stuff that separates the real gamers from what you mean.
People play Moon Shuttle.
Moon Shuttle rocks. Moon Shuttle is a great game. I'm sorry. And that has not been one of my arcade challenges, but it will be one in the future. But actually, for what game I'm playing now, if anybody's really interested, the game that I'm playing, which is awesome, is the Pinball Arcade. I think there was a lost conversation about that once somewhere. But nonetheless, the Pinball Arcade, for $10, you can get it on. It's out on a lot of things. It's on iOS. It's on the Android phone. It's on the Xbox Live Arcade.
I think the basic price of entry on iOS is $3 or $4.
Oh, it's even cheaper on the iOS. It's $10 on Xbox Live Arcade, and a super steal. And another reason why Sony has kind of won me over a little bit. It's also $10, but you get not only the PS3 version, but you get the Vita version, and any DLC that you purchase in the future of extra pinball tables will be able to be played on both the PS3 or the Vita. So you don't have to buy, you know, the Pinball Arcade on the PS3 and the Vita, and then the DLC works. It's just one purchase. Yeah. You got it all. Which
I want
is,
my money back on the
awesome.
Xbox version now.
Yeah, it's awesome for that, you know, for that alone. And a nice thing, too, for the trophy people out there is you have 3 trophies per table, and you have the chance to get those 3 trophies twice, once on the Vita and once on the PS3. So it's essentially 6 per table for people that care about trophies.
Trophy whores.
I kind of am a little bit of a trophy whore, and you're just kind of sad because I'm kicking your ass in the trophy collection.
Yeah,
you're
but
level
Big Sal's kicking both of our asses.
Yeah, as well, yeah, Big Sal just sits and rocks the PS3 a lot.
Big props to Big Sal.
Big Sal. Big Sal, the man.
These are really good versions of these tables, too.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that in the very first update they've included Medieval Madness, which is, in my opinion, the pinnacle of late 90s, you know,
but even
pinball design. It's just one of the last Williams.
There were several. There are Cirque's Voltaire's coming out. That's the last Bally Midway, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, right.
And that will be coming in a future DLC. But the Williams had their last two were the Pinball 2000 ones, which were the ones with the screen. You had the Star Wars, and you had another one. I'm not sure.
You know, close. We're talking like within a couple of years.
A couple of years. It was, you know, towards the end or whatnot. But
anyway, Medieval Madness.
Medieval Madness is great. But even just the base package, you have a really good array of titles. You have one from 81, which is the Black Hole. You have a couple mid-90s ones. You have the Tale of the Arabian Night. Theater of Magic. Those are both kind of around the same year, I think, like 94, 95. And then you have kind of a weird, you know, entry, which is awesome, is from 2004, you have Ripley's Believe It or Not from Stern, which is the well, I shouldn't even say that. The last major manufacturer that's been around, you know, they purchased Sega, and which had purchased that East Pinball.
Stern likes to. They don't like being called the last.
Well, they're
pinball.
Not. They're not.
They
there
like
are other pinball companies that are out there now too,
okay.
as well. But I'm just saying that
say
they were
like
the last major
the
in that.
Yeah.
Well, they. But they're not the only anymore.
Not anymore.
Okay. No, and in fact, actually, in New Jersey, there is Jersey Jack. I think is a guy who's starting a company, or I don't remember the name of the company. I'm sorry about that.
Grassroots pinball growth out there. In America.
Hey, it's you know what? Here's something interesting. Pinball is one of the American forms of entertainment. It's American made. It's American. You know, it wasn't inspiration from somewhere else. It was. Basically out of Chicago, you know, where the major manufacturers. It is Americana.
And from the time of the Prohibition up till 60-something, illegal.
Well, in some states because of people betting on it and whatnot, you know. And that's why, actually, interesting, that's why even up until the end, you would still see them print, this
a
is for recreation only and not,
a game
you know,
of skill.
Skill and recreation only.
That specific phrase, once it was proven, by, you know, in court to be a game of skill and not a game of chance, then it was no longer considered a gambling device.
Yeah. So they to this day, I think even Stern probably prints that, you know, probably out of just, at this point, you know, just nostalgia and whatnot. But there was, I think like a senator or somebody in New York that dumped a whole bunch of pinball machines.
Oh yeah,
it was mayor. Was it mayor? It was the mayor of New York then, because it was New York.
Yeah, one of the bridges.
Bastard! All that good American art thrown away.
I didn't hear about that.
You don't know about that? It's a famous story. Yeah.
So that's like the Atari landfill of pinball.
Yeah, they burned them.
Basically,
they
threw them in the landfill. They threw them out.
There's actually a great documentary on Netflix. Called Special When Lit that has all that history in it.
Yeah. So anyway, the Pinball Arcade, check it out on any number of devices. They're going to support that through DLC for years to come, is what they're claiming. And
two to be exact.
As long as Mike promises to buy every table.
I will buy every table, especially since you buy it once, you play it on PS3 and Vita. You don't see that with Xbox. Yeah, I said it. But anyway, though, but I have played it on an Xbox, and it is great on the Xbox Live Arcade too. There's no doubt the lighting is great. The tables are recreated, amazing. They can actually change the physics on ramps. Compare, you know, they can make it different. You know, going up a ramp than on the normal slope of the table. So you're getting the best, you know, pinball recreation. And so yeah, that's what
we're looking forward to getting to that too.
But basically it.
We're good.
So come check us out, the new website, dpvideogames.com. There's a forum. Feel free to challenge me and any
and
of the arcade challenges.
Chat, so if Mike doesn't seem to be responding to your challenges, you can hang out in the chat room and wait for him to appear. And then take him down.
And then ask him, why is he picking such weird, obscure games?
True story. If you go to your bathroom mirror and say, Mike, you suck three times, he will appear.
I admit that.
And,
you know.
And challenge you to an obscure arcade game, which he will proceed to ram you in.
Like, let's play Space Zap.
He will then...
Exactly what's first.
He will then proceed to ram you in said obscure arcade game, and then you will turn into Mike Rosamilia.
Hey.
And then you will be in a world of shit.
A broken man.
It's true. Can't complain.
But yeah, thank you for spending your time with us.